This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
the
be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hear Shockwall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed. Mm-hmm.
Sharon Lawson Bram, just get him a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Just get him a rinky dink.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pot. What her mouth is cracked, Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious.
5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Tuesday evening. And Scott Criscola, it feels a lot, right? Kind of makes the week seem a little bit shorter, though, in a nice way. Like, usually I'm coming down here thinking, oh, God, it's only Monday. I got a full week ahead of me. But you know what? Tomorrow's already Wednesday. It's hump day. How you doing?
I am well, JR. Today is pre-hump day, the hump pre-game show. Humpback. Silverback. Saw him today, too. Welcome, everyone, to episode 436 of The Gold Standard. And, I got to, last night I watched the Stags, gack a 14-point lead and lose. But in any event, we are here this evening, continuing our trek through the fantastic year that is 1985. And, of course, we won't talk much about Sunday night because you and I would rather have our heads put in the oven than to talk about Sunday night. But
I've already moved on. I'm done. I don't even want to think about it. Don't care.
Yep.
Who cares?
Don't care.
No one gives a shit about football. It sucks. Who cares?
Cares. Nobody cares. No. We're looking forward to the draft.
Trash. I'm not. Trash. I don't care. It's all trash.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know. We have like the 27th pick. I don't know.
Who cares? Chris Carter, newest Yankee. That's what I'm excited about.
Yes. How many homers did he have for the eight?
38 from Milwaukee last year.
Yes, and 210 strikeouts.
Whatever.
Great to have Rich Jackson back.
Give me some dingers.
That's fine. It's a good stopgap for the future.
So. Give me those dongs.
Interesting question today before we move on about sports, and it has nothing to do with the Patriots. Don't worry about it. So I guess something came up today. They were talking about the Michael Kay show, one of the local New York. I know. Believe me. Trust me. His example pissed me off anyway. So. I guess there's a rumor that Major League Baseball is going to try and not shorten the game because tighten the pacing of it by A, making the strike zone bigger, having the strike zone move up to the
– which makes me laugh because I feel like they don't know what the fucking strike zone is now. Like, oh, we're going to widen it by 2 inches. Actually, they're not widening it. They're actually – I don't know if you misspoke or you misheard them. They're making it smaller.
Oh, I thought they were making it wider.
No, they're trying to give less strikeouts and more.
Oh, okay. And more in play. Okay. Yeah. I see. Okay. This is the one that I really heard, though. They want to eschew the 4 intentional walk pitches. And when a batter comes up, you just say, the catcher just says, we're intentionally walking him, and you go to first base. And, of course, Michael Kay goes, he doesn't even give a good baseball reason for it. He goes, you can't get rid of that. The most exciting moment of the year was when Gary Sanchez hit. Oh, Michael, you just ruined it. You just ruined the fucking argument.
Well, the thing is, too, and there's actually a really good article I read today on The Ringer about this, basically just picking this thing apart, saying like they went through all the math of how many intentional walks they were, how much time it takes, blah, blah, blah. And I think they credited, I don't know if it was Jason Stark or someone. But basically, it's going to save like – it would save like one – I forget the fuck it is. I mean, it's like barely anything. It's like minutes on the season. You know what I mean? It's barely a blip. And basically, the crux of the article was, is there really a problem? Because they're making more money than ever. The ratings are good. People are going to the park. You know, like, it's doing real well. And he's basically saying, the more you keep making it a problem, it's going to eventually become a problem. You know what I mean? Like, if you keep calling attention to it, then you're obviously like eventually going to get people saying, yeah, you know what? Maybe it is too long, because he's saying it's a lot of the purists that are driving this, because they're like, well, back in my day, the game was only an hour and a half. But he's like, well, there were no commercials. They had to hurry the game because they didn't have lights and they didn't play at night. You know, like he's giving all these reasons to say there's a reason why the games are longer now. He said, you know, the real issues are pickoffs, pitching changes. Like that's the stuff that really drags out the game. So, I mean, you're talking radical changes in that case. Now, my big point has always been you could easily streamline instant replay by taking it out of the coach's hands, have someone in the booth that just watches the game and signals down when the call is wrong. And you know what I mean? Like, that would save a ton of time. You just buzz the ump and say, hey, overturn the call, instead of the whole hoo-ha with the you know, with the managers coming out and dancing on the field and pacing around. And there's better ways to do it versus the ump having to walk over and watch the monitor. But anyway, I thought it was a really good piece. I recommend it if anyone's into that, you know, baseball and kind of the rules about it. It was on The Ringer today, so it's a pretty interesting piece. Mm. But, yeah, basically they said it's not going to really do anything, and they should just either make serious changes or shut up about it, because all you're going to do is get enough people concerned about it, whenas right now it seems like no one really cares.
Right. And the funny thing about it is I feel that baseball feels right now, you know, they've been the number two sport for a long time. NFL has been number one since probably the mid to late 70s. And, you know, this is not a stellar year for the NBA, for the NFL. Ratings were down.
Games all pretty much sucked. I mean, other than
games all sucked. Except for one select group, you had a world champion nobody likes. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks they cheat. And you have a commissioner nobody likes. He's not Pete Rozelle.
All the concussion stuff as well.
He's what?
All the concussion stuff, too.
Yeah, and all the concussion stuff. So the NFL, for the first time in probably 35 years, not in a good place right now.
I mean, you could argue if it wasn't for fantasy, they'd be in a whole, you know, a lot more trouble. Like, Vegas and fantasy are what really drive a lot of this. If you were to eliminate fantasy, like you know, like, I don't know how many people would be watching a lot of these games.
I agree with you. I agree with you 100%.
And, I mean, for me, like, when a year like this where the Jets are pretty much done, you know, 5 or 6 weeks in or whatever it was. You know, if it wasn't for me paying attention to fantasy, I'd be like, well, I'd probably be more apt to check out week to week.
Right, exactly. And I mean, merchandise was not terrible. I mean, you did have some exciting new people this year. Obviously, my team had two of them, Dak and Zeke, and jerseys were bought, and you had some other guys, and people jumped on the Rodgers bandwagon and bought stuff, and the Matt Ryan bandwagon, you know. So I think merchandise didn't do that bad, but. Yeah, nobody was watching the games. The playoffs fucking sucked from beginning to end. You didn't have one exciting game. Even Sunday's game wasn't that great. We were having a little discussion. Is that the greatest game of all time? No, it's not. The game sucked for, what, 3.5 quarters or whatever? I mean, it was awful. It wasn't Giants-Bills or Steelers-Cardinals or the second Steeler-Cowboy game in 78. It wasn't a great game. The game was terrible till about, I don't know, 2 minutes ago in the third quarter. So I think Major League Baseball needs to just shut up, play your game, shorten the break. That's what they need to do. They need to shorten commercials. That's what they need to do. Don't fuck with the game.
What they should look into do more is in-game, and I think ESPN did this a few times where they stay between innings and just do more in-game ads, like do reads, do more sponsorships, you know, this inning sponsored by this. I think ESPN was doing that a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the bigger problems really is the playoff games running really long, because those start late.
Yes.
And you're talking about World Series games ending, you know, 11:30 midnight. And I would argue that's probably the bigger problem than just like regular season games. Like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's baseball. It's going to be long. It is what it is. Right. But it's the perfect sport for you to sit back and not have to be plugged in at your TV throughout the entire game. And I'm not saying that's what baseball wants to hear, but, you know, I'm fine having the Yankee game on my iPad or my phone off to the side and, you know, monitoring it. Or if it's on the radio as I'm in and out of the car, like, it's –
whatever. Yeah. I like that baseball's on all day. You know, that the games take a while and it's not in and out. Now, going to a game can be a little bit different, but whatever. I think, you know, in most cities, I think baseball is the cheapest game to attend because there's so many of them. I mean, there are some areas like here, you know, in Boston where Fenway can be ridiculous to attend, but there are also not a ton of seats there. Right. But most stadiums you can get in for you know, a pence, you know, whatever you want to say.
Yes.
But, you know, $20 or, you know, I went to a Rangers game last year and it was like, you know, you buy a fucking hot dog and you get the ticket for $3. You know, it was like some Tuesday night deal. So it's, I mean, they have all kinds of stuff going on to get people in the game. So I don't think it's a problem. I think there are ways to clean it up. You know, me, I'm a big fan of like automating the strike zone and stuff like that. I think that would save a lot of time and trouble. But I mean, Chitty. To me,
Umpires Union would never go for that though.
Oh, fuck them. They should be better at the job and it wouldn't be an issue. But
well,
I mean,
I agree with you 100% on that too.
To me, changing the strike zone by 2 inches is going to be so negligible. Like, I don't, do the umpires even know what 2 inches is? Like, how do you even tell? Like, this is dumb. To me, this is dumb. I think unless you're going to make serious radical changes like limiting pickoffs, limiting pitching changes and stuff like that, which would affect the game in a pretty serious way, then I think all this other stuff is just cosmetic nonsense that keeps, you know, calling a problem. The comparison he used was a good one. It was basically like, you know, you picked at a scab and you come into, or a pimple, you know, burst a pimple on your face and you come in to work with like full bandages wrapped around your head, calling attention to something no one probably would have ever noticed. So it's like, you know, is shortening the game from 306 to 303 like that big of a fucking deal that it's worth trumpeting about? Probably not.
Right. No, exactly not. No, I agree. But I think this is a big year for baseball because, I mean, the parity's there again. I think the expansion of playoffs is good. You see different teams in it now and, you know, as much as I didn't want to see them, you know, as much as I didn't want to lose, it was good for baseball to have a team like Kansas City win last year. And obviously Cubs Indians was gigantic. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, JR, there was one game due to weather that I think started at 7. Yeah. I think one of the first two games at Progressive started at 7 and it still ended at like 10:30, quarter of 11. It's not the game. It's Fox. And they're 4 minute breaks. I mean,
it is the game too. I mean, there's a lot more pitching changes, a lot more deliberation between pitches. I mean, that's why, you know, and it's funny because people still say it, but it's not really true. Like Yankees, Red Sox, you just take forever. They really don't. They've actually had some of the shortest games they've ever had this past couple of years. But, you know, there was a time in the 2000s where every game between them felt like a World Series game, you know. And it was like every game was so stressful and so, you know, particular.
Right.
But that's not really the case for the majority of games. You're not getting that level of scrutiny. But in the World Series, you are. You're more, especially with a guy like Madden involved, but you're more likely to have, you know, a pitching change after pitching change after pitching change in the biggest game of the year versus game 37 against Detroit, which may be a big game, but you're probably not as likely to have a quick hook with your reliever and that kind of stuff, you know? So it's like, exactly. There is a big difference with those games, and I don't know how you do it. Like, I understand saying starting it at 7 screws people on the West Coast or whatever, so it's a balancing act. But if I were them, I'd shut up and enjoy the money and the ratings and just cruise along because you're right, the NFL is in trouble. And they're also in trouble a little bit too from, you know, where are they going to fill these roster spots? Because I think more and more parents are going to be reluctant to let their children play football. And I think more and more are going to turn to sports like baseball. Like baseball's, you know, still huge in the Dominican Republic and other, you know, Latin American countries. And I think it'll see an increase again in the United States as more and more people turn away from football and towards baseball only because there's so many roster spots and so many chances in baseball too.
Right. Exactly. You know, baseball is also a very regional sport in the sense that it's not like football where, I mean, I would root for a team that's not close by, but I mean, it, you know, it depends on when you grew up but baseball, you pretty much root for the team. There's not a lot of guys that root for weird teams. Like the guy Carl at work roots for Oakland and he's from, you know, New Rochelle.
Right.
You root for a team close. I root for a team close, you know, D'Amato, et cetera. You know, Willie roots for the Cubs, that kind of thing. Baseball is very different like that. You're very localized, whereas football, we root for everybody. And football is also a very player centric sport like the NBA is. I mean, a lot of fans that wore Bulls stuff in the 90s, it's because they love Michael. And then once he left and Floyd went in and they lost 60 something games the next year, all the Bulls stuff went out the window. So it's going to be interesting this year. I'm looking forward to baseball. I really am. Pitchers and catchers very soon, actually, a couple weeks. But anyway, let's shift gears. We will talk baseball a little bit later on in the show. But anyway, let's head to our offices. Because we have a pretty good show tonight. We got some high spots. We got a boatload of low spots. But entertainment nonetheless. Tonight, it is July 13th, 85, live from Madison Square Garden in beloved New York City. It is a Saturday night, JR.
Interesting.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So second straight month that we have a house show not on a Monday, because we always used to think, wow, they're always on Mondays. Oh, they're not always. The last one was on a Friday. This one was on a Saturday. And I'm looking it up right now. As usual, there were two shows on this night. But it looks like based on these two cards, JR, a lot of, you know, muckety mucks actually had like the night off, because I will tell you right off the bat, Hogan is not on either of these shows. So he's not here at the Garden, and he's not where we are, where the other place is, which JR, by the way, is a, you will see it a lot 9 years later, because they are at a bastion of Monday Night Raw. You know where they are? You know where the other building is? The
Booger, Bastion Booger.
The Beagley Center, yes, the Booger, the Beagley Center in Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, yes, classic arena.
Classic arena. Of course, Vince used to call it Beagley, Ohio. Moron. Anyway, that card, 3,200. Les Thornton pins Sal Bellomo. Barry O beats Steve Lombardi. No wonder there are only 3,200 people. B. Brian Blair pinned Terry Gibbs. The Spoiler defeated Jimmy Jackson. What, didn't he play for Ohio State?
Right.
Randy Savage, the Macho Man, pinned SD Jones. That match was 15-26. That match actually was pretty good, too. Tony Atlas and Ricky Steamboat defeated Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji. And your main event, your Intercontinental Champion. Oh, yes, we have a title change to talk about, JR.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about it in a moment. Might as well bring it up now because it is part of this main event. Why don't we dive into the Sutton report before we discuss this, because I'm sure he mentions it. Last card, JR, we had a title change as the U.S. Express regained the tag team titles. What about our Intercontinental Championship?
Well, Sutton lists our champions, indeed. Mm-hmm. So our world champion, still Hulk Hogan, 537 days into his reign. Our Intercontinental Champion, Tito Santana, 7 days into his reign,
having finally
ended Greg Valentine's reign at 285 days, back on July 6th at the Baltimore Arena.
Fantastic match.
Yes, the match was in a steel cage. Santana climbed over the top and hit the floor before Valentine at 10:25.
Yep, and it was a great ending, too, because he was crawling. He was crawling. It was actually pretty vicious. He was crawling down this. I remember this very, very well. He was crawling down the wall. And Hammer was trying to climb out the door, and he kicks the door square in Valentine's face. I mean, it was not like a chintzy shot. I mean, he pasted him, and he climbed out, and Tito won the title. But another memorable thing happened, JR, right after the match. Greg Valentine was so incensed at his Intercontinental title loss, he took the green belt, and he beat the crap out of it. He smashed it against the walls of the cage, destroyed the green Intercontinental Championship belt. Which means, of course, the next belt you see, JR, many people consider the coolest-looking belt in the history of wrestling. Of course, it is the classic Intercontinental Championship belt, which you will see for the next 13 years in WWE. So, WWF. So, that came from there. So, your main event on this show was the rematch in the cage, and Tito defeated Hammer in 12:57. So, there was your card that day, also at the Beagley Center in Youngstown, Ohio. Anything else in the report, JR?
Well, the rest of our championship roll call, the U.S. Express, 26 days into their reign, and Wendy Richter, 104 days into her reign as women's champion. We also have some notes from Mr. Jarvis here, some tidbits that have gone down since our last show back in June. On 6/22 episode of Championship Wrestling, Lord Alfred Hayes announced the signing of a major star, Terry Funk, to a WWF contract. In his first match the following week, Funk was giving his ring gear to ring attendant Mel Phillips.
Yep.
Prior to the start of the match, his hands were full of gear, so Phillips put on Funk's cowboy hat. Funk beat him up and subsequently was fined $5,000 for his actions, and we'll talk more about him in a bit.
Yes.
On 6/29 show, Piper's Pit, Piper had Hillbilly Jim as a guest, and Jim introduced us to another new acquisition, Uncle Elmer. Seeing him.
Yep.
By the way, a little nostalgia note, 6/29 episode of Championship Wrestling debuts the infamous Lord Alfred Hayes soundbites. Promotional consideration paid for by the following, which you hear on each and every podcast here at Place to Be Nation.
that's absolutely true.
Randy Savage, we talked about last month. He makes his television debut on the 7-6 Championship Wrestling with several managers coming out to the ring to scout this new hot talent in the WWF. And on 7-8 at Sullivan Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, we had the first ever King of the Ring tournament.
Yes.
We want to run through here the brackets. In the opening round, Don Morocco defeated Junkyard Dog. Les Thornton knocked off Steve Lombardi.
Bob Orton Jr. and Paul Orndorff wrestled to a double disqualification. Pedro Morales beat Johnny V. Tito Santana beat Terry Funk by DQ. Jim Brunzel knocked off the Spoiler. Ricky Steamboat beat Greg Valentine. And the Iron Sheik defeated B. Brian Blair. Don Morocco then would beat Thornton. Morales advanced due to the bye thanks to the double DQ. Jim Brunzel and Tito Santana went to a draw, and Brunzel advanced on a coin toss.
Sounds like a Belichick Brady thing right there.
Very odd. And the Iron Sheik actually pinned Ricky Steamboat. So your final four, Don Morocco defeated Pedro Morales. Iron Sheik defeated Jim Brunzel. And in an all-heel final, Don Morocco pinned the Iron Sheik to win the first ever King of the Ring tournament. Very odd format.
Take that, Parv.
Why not just put Steamboat or Santana or Brunzel in that match?
I know. No idea. That's so weird. And by the way, they did have some extra matches. Mm-hmm. Actually, they had one extra match. The main event, Hogan defeated Nikolai to retain the world title. That was there. That was the main event. So it was kind of like it was almost like a Great American Bash to a certain mm-hmm. extent. You know, you kind of big outdoor show, a lot of matches, and then like the champion.
Yep.
So pretty cool.
And then on the 7/13 Championship Wrestling, we saw the match where the tag titles changed hands when Wyndham and Rotundo defeated Sheik and Volkoff at 3/13 to regain the tag team titles.
3/13, so bad. Ugh, it's a shame. So there you go, which takes us to this evening, 15,000 inside our office, JR, Madison Square Garden. On our good fan, the Broham, Graham Cawthon, on the history of WWE.com. He doesn't mention if the Felt Forum has any extra seats. Probably not. Because to be honest with you, this show seemed, in terms of star power, seemed a little flat. Remember, as you could tell, Tito was at was in Youngstown, mm-hmm. but no Hogan and no U.S. Express.
Right.
We'll see if they're on this show. Well, I already mentioned Hogan wasn't. We'll see if the tag team champions are.
We should also mention we have brand new announce team here because Mean Gene's days are done as Gorilla Monsoon and Lord Alfred Hayes are in the booth. Alfred, of course, had filled in for Gene halfway through a show a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. But I believe this is pretty much the tandem that lasts for quite a while, right, here at MSG?
Yep, thank God. I was Mean Gene'd out of commentary.
I didn't mind his run. I didn't think he was that bad. I mean, we've covered it in detail, but Alfred was good too.
Oh, I love Alfred. Alfred has some good isms as well that I'll bring up in my quotes. But loved Gorilla's tux. Did you see the tux tonight?
Yes, classic.
A white tuxedo with, what was that, lime green ruffled shirt? It was tremendous.
It was. It was the peak 1985.
Yes, tremendous tuxedo for Gino on this day. All right, let's dive in. It was a busy day in entertainment mm-hmm. on this day, JR, and we'll bring it up later on in the pop culture report. A huge day in music history on this date. So, all right, let's go to our opener. And the minute I saw these first two, I went, oh, God, here comes the drizzler. what do we got in our opener?
Ah, good old favorite Polish wrestler, Ivan Putski, taking on Moondog Spots. And it definitely was in contention for the Drizzler, that's for sure. We'll see if it reaches that status.
Yes.
So interesting spot for Putski opening the show, and he is as juiced as ever. Spotty's back, as always. Gorilla references that bone right out of the gate. Kind of gets a set, and I kind of, you know, I listen for it, and then it gets me right on track for the show the rest of the night. Gorilla now gushing over Ivan's body, talking about how tan ripped he is. Putski overpowers early as we alternate between lockups and stalling. Putski survives a headbutt and drills Spot in the gut with a right hand before grinding a side headlock for quite a while. Ivan lands a couple of stray shots but keeps working the headlock until Spot finally breaks the hold with an atomic drop. Spot shakes off the cobwebs and starts to kick and punch away at Ivan. Putski comes back, but Spot hits an inverted atomic drop to cut him off, followed by a knee and a chin lock. Alfred then puts over Spot's skill despite being primitive. Spot cuts off a comeback with a backbreaker for two, goes back to the chin lock. Ivan comes back with an atomic drop, but Spot dodges an elbow drop and then hits a clubbing blow to the head off the middle rope for two. Spot goes back to the chin lock and then releases and works some strikes. Putski reverses a whip to the corner, leading to both men colliding and collapsing. Putski fires up and unloads the offense, usually eventually getting Spot tied up in the ropes. Putski stays aggressive until the referee finally frees Spot, who's able to kick Putski low. Ivan recovers and levels Spot with the Polish hammer for the win. I thought this was way too slow, way too sluggish. There was a couple of bright spots here and there. It was technically fine. It was just really fucking boring. And Putski's cooked. He should just be working squash matches, not these extended rest hold fiestas like this. And I thought it was the usual Spot stuff. A little more bland than we're used to from him. I went a half star. I went above dud because, again, there was nothing like technically wrong with it. It was just really just not the best way to start off a long night of wrestling, giving these guys as much time. And they went
12:58.
Yeah, that's too long for this.
That's way too long. That's way too long. Yeah, I wanted to give it a dud, but I use your philosophy. You really can't. I mean, unless something's really just truly, truly liquid drizzling, you got to at least give it a half star. But I agree with you. Putski should not be doing anything over 5 minutes. And Spotty, you know, got to give the guy credit. The more as we've watched him on these house shows, Spotty is really a good, like, slip-in heel guy. I mean, he has basic offense, but I'm not looking for Ricky Steamboat or anything, or the Iron Sheik, you know, technical whiz-bang, you know, suplexes or whatever. I'm looking for just a basic guy that could give me 10 decent minutes. And yeah, why doesn't fucking Putski eat the chicken parma? Good grief. What, did he lose all his fucking hair when he took all those roids?
Right, I know.
Jesus, he was – in 1975, he had this big beer gut and all the chest hair and hair in his back, and now he's like all shiny and everything with this bad toupee. Oh, my God. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible. But Spotty's just one of those guys. I mean, I got a lot of love for Spotty, you know, because he could slip him into a decent house show match. He'll work, you know, but he's a guy that could work 11, 12 minutes. He's got a little gimmick, and he can – do basic stuff, but Putski just bumbles around the ring and hits the stupid hammer, and they made the ending so stupid. Like, Spotty's not an idiot,
right?
And they do the whole, here's the you know, the leapfrog, and he stands there. Oh, he never does that before. Yeah. Why? So this asshole can set up his stupid fucking hammer finisher.
It was a
terrible ending to that match. I'll give it a half star, but I agree with you. Putski should not be doing
not 12-minute openers. I mean,
12-minute openers
filled with rest holes and everything else. I mean, yeah, Spotty's almost better suited than he is for like a longer match with,
right,
you know, because he can pick up the pace and slow it down. Putski's just ambling around out there. He's so overjuiced. If you have to use Putski, it should be one of two ways: a quick squash, like just to pop the fans, or kind of like, you know, like we've seen with some other older veterans, where he's just there to put over younger guys. Like, he'd be putting over a guy like a Savage or something like that. And maybe we're getting there. I mean, maybe they're just reestablishing him, and then we'll get to that. But that's what he should be used for, not winning long fucking marathon matches to open the show over other scrubs.
No, absolutely not. And shine on the freeway and guide her AMC. I could see him driving an AMC. What was the name of the bar?
The Warsaw. Yeah.
The Warsaw. Okay, I want to make sure. I knew it was a cool name. God, when did that show go off the air? Like 2000.
It was a while. It was late. I think we've talked about it before, but I think it went.
Have
in.
We?
Yeah, it went longer than it seemed like it did.
Yeah. Was it still on when he was at the 01 Rumble?
Yeah, well, it ran from 95 to 04.
Okay. Good show.
Yep.
Of course, most of the guys then did Whose Line Is It Anyway, or whatever the
great
show is.
Yep.
Tremendous show. Do you ever watch the British version?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's pretty good. They're both good. All right. And actually, those shows be better than watching this match again. Putski wins 12:58. It's not good, and I agree with you. Spotty got suckered into this, and it sucks. And even the crowd. Usually the crowd will even – and, you know, I mean, let's – to take off the 2017 wrestling fan hat, fans get into everybody back in the 80s. Everybody cheers. But even – I felt like even here you're like, oh, even that – even –
well, they pop a bit when he comes out and gets going, but the match just goes. I mean, it was just too long. I mean, that's really all it is. It was too long for what they were trying to do. This would have been better suited, like right after the intermission or something, in a quick sprint. Just, it was not a 12-minute. Putski's not made for a 12-minute opening match.
No, you got to put somebody better in that opener. So, pass those radar mounties, bring her to Lake County. Moon over Parma tonight. Steve Allen write that? And how is your sister tonight? Putski wins in 12:58, and we'll never get those 13 minutes back ever again.
Putski, though, I'm putting him in the bucket. Possible juice contender. Who is it named after currently?
It's named after, I believe,
Mr.
it's
Wonderful.
Named after Tony Atlas.
Yes. No, we'll it's the Mr. Wonderful Award.
It's named after Orndorff. That's right. It has been named after.
we might be throwing Putski in the mix after tonight. We'll see. But he's got immediate competition, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Yes, because next up is the guy that's always getting this award because, you know, when you're 3'3" and you look like a fucking tree stump, This is what happens. But the length of this match, JR, should have been the length of our last match. Right. But who do we got in match number two?
We have our buddy, the Missing Link, back here. Is this his third match or second?
Third.
Third, right? Yeah,
it's his third match.
Yeah, so he's back here for a third month against our old pal, the Pill Poppin' Quick Draw Rick McGraw. And he is definitely giving Putski a run for his money. So we are two for two out of the gate here in the Mr. Wonderful Award category. But McGraw back on the scene has an interesting challenge this month, the mysterious Missing Link. Link tries to bring the chair into the ring as usual, but Bobby Heenan stops him. Gorilla wonders how Heenan's even controlling this guy. Alfred thinks he may go to the WWF Commission to explain what this is all about. McGraw comes hot off the bell, unloading a big flurry of right hands and a dropkick. As the crowd's popping, Link quickly recovers and dives at McGraw, leveling him with a headbutt that sends McGraw hard to the mat. Link hits a second headbutt, and it flies into Quick Draw off the middle rope. Link goes to the chair again, but Heenan yanks it away. Quick Draw tries to run Link into the buckle, but Link shrugs it off and hammers back at him. McGraw reverses a whip, but Link charges into him with a headbutt to the chest. Link then follows with a diving bomb off the middle ropes for the win. I thought it was another fun Link squash. He just wrecked Quick Draw with a really sharp, hard-hitting offense. McGraw was really good here, too, showing lots of fire at the bell. And the crowd bought in. I gave it a dud, only because it was pretty much a squash. But actually, I kind of enjoyed it. I think Link has been better than I expected him to be. He's really all over the place. Like, he's constant energy and movement. And he has this unorthodox offense where he just lunges at people and, like, throws his body around. And I thought McGraw's comebacks were pretty good here. So, actually, this was a decent little squash. I thought it got the point across pretty well. I like the interactions, even though it still doesn't fully make sense. Link and Heenan as a pairing, I thought they've worked well together, even though you think he'd be better suited with a guy like a Fuji, they've at least played off each other nicely.
Yeah, I give this I'll give it a dud because, a squash you can't really grade, but they're doing the right thing with Missing Link. This is what you're supposed to do with him. He's supposed to be, a mystery, an enigma wrapped in a puzzle or whatever. I mean, he's supposed to do nothing but run around like a lunatic and take out guys. And, I'm sure Rick McGraw wasn't thrilled. He probably took a few more Nandrolones or whatever the hell he was popping. And, and that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, the only thing that I've been criticizing about the Missing Link is really not him specifically, but he shouldn't be with Bobby. It just... Yeah. Logically.
But they've at least made it. They've at least told the story okay, to right. where it's not completely like ridiculous. Like because they're basically putting it off as Heenan got fucked by Orndorff. He's trying to get the bounty. He's bringing in this mercenary who he can barely control. Mm-hmm. It's almost like he doesn't even want him to be in his stable. It's like you can't even fucking stand him when you look at him. Like he's so annoyed. But he's only doing it because he wants to take out Orndorff. So like it works on some level.
Yeah, I'll give credit to that. Yeah. And that's actually a good storyline hook that you would think in 1985 maybe they wouldn't think of. But it actually works out for Bobby. And you see Bobby again later on with a guy that I never remember him being with. But anyway. But that's there's not much more to say. I mean, McGraw was a good, he had to fit in there. And tough shit if you don't like it. Sure, he wasn't
thrilled. He's not fitting into much.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. So in 225, the Missing Link moves on. He's got a lot of shine here at the Garden, huh? Mm-hmm. Three matches since his debut. So that's pretty good.
Well, he's on that Bundy track like we talked about. Bundy was on back in the spring, around Mania, where he was just wrecking guys, and that's where Link is right now. And this was good. It was well-timed. It was well-worked. I enjoyed the squash. 225, perfect length.
Perfect length. Next up, we have two – I was actually looking forward to this match when I saw these two guys' names, two grizzled veterans of the 70s.
Really? After what we watched with Morales last time? And what we've seen of Goulet, you were looking forward to this fucking match?
Hey, look, I was giving our man from Nice, France a little credit here. Of course, we're talking about the great René Goulet. And Pedro's last match was not stellar, but I had a feeling at least obviously I'll let you give your analysis first, but I don't know. I had a good feeling going into this match. I don't know why. I thought maybe Pedro shook off a little rust and maybe looked pretty good, but I'll let you go ahead. But obviously, two guys, former champions from the 70s. Of course, Pedro, former everything champion. And, of course, René was former tag team champion. So, I don't know. I felt like maybe Pedro shook it off and maybe didn't put on a bad match. But floor is yours. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Parv talked a lot about Pedro, too, and how bad he was. So I put credence on that. He's probably watched way more Pedro than we have.
That is true.
So I weigh that heavily when I adjust my anticipation before matches. But Pedro returns and hopefully shows more here than we saw last time. Goulet back after a month off, still has the old black glove, the Michael Jackson one, still missing. Alfred said he lost it and couldn't afford a new one. So weird little storyline we'll track here. Goulet grabs a go-behind to open things up, but Pedro quickly forces the break. Rene then goes to the arm, but Pedro reverses that, begins to work the arm as well. Morales turns that into a side headlock, working Rene to the mat. Goulet fights up, but Pedro plants him with a shoulder block and goes back to the headlock. They continue to battle over basic holds, trading control until Goulet is able to break Pedro down and hook a leg. Pedro breaks free, but Goulet maintains control, landing in some punches and kicks. Pedro bows up out of the corner, and Goulet instantly bails to the apron to avoid him. Goulet comes back in, but reaches into his tights and then backs off. Pedro grabs hold of the arm out of a lockup, but Goulet goes to the eyes and then kicks away. Goulet rams Pedro's shoulder into the post and suplexes him back into the ring for one. Goulet goes to the dreaded claw hold and leaves it locked on for a while. As Pedro lays around before finally getting to his feet and punching out, Goulet again goes to the eyes and hammers away, but Pedro recovers and fires back. Pedro fires up and unloads punches before hitting an atomic drop for two. Goulet whiffs on a right hand, and Pedro slugs him in the gut and then gets a small package for the win. Again, another technically fine match that was very dull, very mind-numbing, I found, to watch 12 minutes of this. Meandering offense, a long claw hold, couple of decent spots keep it again above a dud. I thought Pedro looked better than he did back in May, but still super boring, this match. I went half a star, pretty much in the same bucket as that opener. Just nothing I ever want to watch again, ever. Those two matches are like the biggest waste of 30 minutes of my life, watching those things. Alfred was the highlight of both.
Yeah, I definitely got disappointed after my excitement. Not my excitement, but I was expecting something a little better, and it wasn't. Your official time was 12:56. Oof. So those two matches were combined 25:40-something. So, yeah, about 26 minutes you'll never get
back.
Way
too much.
Yeah, way too much. I mean, basic offense, nothing crazy. The claw segment seemed to go on really long.
It was rough.
It was rough. And the crowd, like I've said, JR, I feel like the crowd actually is tuned into it tonight in that sense. Like, they're not as – For an awesome, you know, Madison Square Garden, mid-80s house show, even the crowd is not totally into it.
You think it's a Saturday thing, or do you think it's just the matches we've seen so far?
I think it's the matches. I don't think Saturday has anything to do with it. Obviously, it's, you know, it's summer, so there's no Knicks or Rangers or anything. So,
just the fact that it's a, you know, Saturday night are more people out and about versus like a Monday where they're more likely to be like the, you know, a bigger crowd, maybe more fans in the house.
That's possible. Sure.
I don't know. Does Graham have the attendance? Oh, he's got 15,000.
He's got 15,000, and like I said, he didn't mention whether the Felt Forum was full. I doubt it was, but usually they would do that probably if Hogan's there. But
that's a little shy though. Like in June, they had 19,800. So, you know, you're about maybe 4,000 less than normal with the Saturday night crowd. So
yeah, no, it's possible. But I feel like that they've definitely not been tuned into these matches early on. Like, and you don't think that way with mid-80s crowds. They're not like smarky like, you know, fans are now.
They were in their own way. But, two, I mean, you wonder, too, if the drawing – I mean, we'll see a couple of stars on the show, but like you said, no Hogan. You know, like, so it's – I wonder, too, a Saturday night, no huge drawing match. There is a really big match on the card, but other than that, there's really not much going on the show. So you wonder if all that kind of, you know, crested into this just not being the usual red-hot crowd. But we'll see if they pick up. We'll talk.
I mean, maybe they took advantage of the fact that it's summertime. Maybe people are on vacation, so they didn't want to – they knew that it wasn't going to be a big crowd anyway, so they didn't go too crazy with – bringing a lot of, you know, hot guys in, but, you know, so it's interesting. Anyway, Pedro gets the win in 12:56. Next up, another.
I don't know who I'd pay more to go away right now, Pedro Putski.
Pedro, because Pedro at least eventually will put guys over. I mean, guy knows Putski probably still thinks he can be world champion. Our next match, here's the interesting thing. You know, JR, again, I've been a fan a long time, and I thought I knew every guy that managed everybody, but this kind of shocked me, at least this match, because I never remembered this, taking on another jobber that we thought was a lot better than he probably was. But anyway, what do we have for match number four?
Well, we actually have a debut here for us tonight. We'll be looking at Adrian Adonis. Keith Frank made his pro debut in 1974, eventually adopting that ring name, Adrian Adonis, and a biker gimmick later in the decade. Around the same time, he hooked up with the AWA, where he formed a successful team with Jesse Ventura, known as the East-West Connection. They would have a year-long reign as tag team champs. beginning in June of 80. In late 81, both Ventura and Adonis left for the WWF, where they competed as a tag team as well as singles competitors. When Ventura was forced to the sidelines with those blood clot issues, Adonis formed a new team with Dick Murdoch in 1983. On April 17th, 84, they won the tag team titles, which they held until January of 85. During this time, Adonis began to bulk up, putting on a large amount of weight as the months rolled along. He would split with Murdoch and actually took on Bobby Heenan as a manager for a brief stretch before we get to his eventual switch, which we'll cover in a few shows, I'm sure. But yes, indeed, Adonis, now managed by Bobby Heenan, the Fink announces. And we haven't really seen him. He's been kind of quiet since him and Murdoch, who are a great team, lost the tag titles to the U.S. Express early in the year.
Yep.
And of course, we watched that TNT, if you remember, where they showed up and were messing up. Was it Jay Strongbow?
Chief Jay Strongbow, remember they were doing the the stupid rain dance outside in the parking lot in, at TNT, and they pull up in their Cadillac honking horns and throwing beer cans. They're fucking hilarious.
And, of course,
and then they do the vignettes where they go to the Bowery or wherever where Adonis lives.
Yep, and then they go to the ranch. Gene goes out on the road. Yeah, I mean, it was great stuff. It was really good stuff.
And they were awesome.
So Adonis, you know, kind of seems like he's being rebooted a bit. Decked out in all of his New York gear here, set to battle the Jobber Deluxe, Jose Luis Rivera, who we've talked about as well quite a bit. Adonis also has an attaché case with him that says, "Relax, Trudy," cuffed to his wrist. So we'll see what Trudy is as we move along. Gorilla assumes that that case is housing the bounty that Heenan has on Orndorff's head. So we'll see.
That
was a good observation by Gorilla. Adonis takes Rivera down off the bell, grabs hold of the leg. Alfred puts over the move and hold, and Gorilla says, "You can't doubt Adrian's wrestling ability." Heenan pops in on commentary to put over Adonis and tease about the briefcase. Adonis releases the hold and gets trapped in an armbar, but he twists out, grabs a head scissors. Alfred puts over Rivera as a youngster who has great ideas about the world of wrestling. Is he writing a thesis paper? I was like, he has great ideas about wrestling. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Gorilla puts him over for taking on tough matches to build up his resume and build up his name. He's not just taking layups or cupcakes. Adonis turns into a chin lock and then plants Rivera with a shoulder block. Rivera takes Adonis over with a hip toss and it goes to the arm, but Adonis fights up and hits a hard inverted atomic drop. Adonis hoists Rivera up and suplexes him down into the middle rope and then shoves Rivera to the floor. Rivera makes it back in, but Adonis just keeps hammering away at him, cutting off comeback attempts. Adonis slams Rivera, drags him up, and drops him with a DDT, which Gorilla calls an underarm pile driver. Adonis keeps slugging and kicking away with the crowd, tries to rally Rivera as he does what he can to pull himself to his feet. Adonis takes Rivera over the back suplex for two and then slings him into the metal turnbuckle before kicking him to the floor. Rivera fights his way back to the ring, but Adonis kills his momentum and rams him to the mat with a bulldog. Adonis then follows out with a noogie to the temple, which Gorilla calls a Japanese sleeper hold, for the win as Rivera passes out. This was a pretty solid match. I liked it. It was kind of a bully match where Adonis just beats the piss out of Rivera with his heavy leaning offense. And I actually thought this was a breakthrough match for Rivera. He only botched one spot. The crowd is behind him during that little flurry when Adonis was pulling him and he kept fighting to his feet. Like, I really enjoyed that spot, and the crowd was into it. I thought this is the best match we've seen of him easily so far. I like bully Adonis with Heenan as a manager. Like, I think that's a really strong heel act. We'll see where they're going with it, but I kind of like it. So I go a star and a half on this match. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Best match of the night so far.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a star and a half as well. Graham did not have a time, so I actually timed the match on my phone today.
Look at you, fancy.
So bell to bell, it was 10:29.
What do you think of the Japanese sleeper hold?
It's a noogie. It's funny. D'Amato was over. He was over with us at the game Sunday, and he walks up to me, goes, "Oh, I see. I hear you're doing this next house show." He goes, "Wait till you see the noogie." What the fuck is he talking about? And then I go, "Oh," and then I message him. I said, "Oh, I just saw the noogie." You know, like, what kind of fucking finisher is that? Anyway, other than that, I really did enjoy this match. You're right. I think now, as weird as the whole Bobby Link thing is, Adonis is a perfect guy for Bobby. He's smart. He talks. He can, you know, he's got his own good promo skills, and he's, you know, he's a money grubbing guy. Mm-hmm. And Bobby uses him as a more muscle for Orndorff, even though he can't really see Adonis have much muscle right now.
Right.
But it was a great match. He still kind of had that awesome chip on his shoulder, like when he was with Dirty Dick. So
and his offense is so good. It's so, like, I mean, I don't mean this in a demeaning, like, fat way, but it's so heavy. Like, I like when big men have heavy offense where they just lean on you and just pound on you. And that's what he does here. And that's why I like that spot so much, where Rivera has just been a punching bag since we've started watching these shows, that, like, trips over his own feet all the time, actually pieced it together for this one match and just keeps fighting to his feet as Adonis is just hammering away at him. And the crowd bought right in. It was cool. I enjoyed it. I like the commentary on this match, too. I love the fucking... He has great ideas on wrestling. And the
yes.
Of course, the underarm pile driver, the Japanese sleeper hold. Like, it was just, there was a lot of fun stuff here. Yep. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Alfred and Gorilla have been impressive so far, as far as it's much more conversational. With Gene, it was very soundbitey. Like, him and Gorilla were both trying to hit the soundbites, whereas Alfred is just, you know, talking inane nonsense. And Gorilla buys into it. It feels like it's more organic, the conversation. Whereas I enjoyed Gene, but it was a lot more like just kind of talking separately. Whereas right. This feels like they're having more of a discussion.
Yes, I agree. Except Alfred, I don't know where he was going with this. Alfred, I think sometimes kind of overtalks himself. But in the beginning, when he was describing Adonis, he said supple. He goes, Adonis, he's in great shape. He's very supple.
Well, he is supple. He's definitely supple.
And I went, what? I said, well, you are right. He is kind of supple. But I'm like, I had no idea where Alfred was going with that. He was very supple. Yeah, I'm sure he is. oh, God. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I liked the match. I mean, I'm an Adonis fan anyway. I like kind of the bullying. Still had the Murdoch tag team title offense. I enjoy that a lot. Rivera didn't look like a big, you know, clumsy buffoon fumbling around, not knowing what to do. He went with the – he kind of rode the – he figured out the psychology. I think that was one thing we were saying in some of the earlier matches that he's been bad at is he wasn't grabbing the match's psychology and what his opponents were handing him. Adonis was handing him this psychology of, look, try to get up. This crowd will get behind you. Get the fuck up. You know what I mean? And he kept leaning on him and leaning on him, and he's trying to get up, and he's finally figuring out, oh, I get it now. And the crowd starts. I think it's the first time on this card that we're seeing the audience really start getting into things now and getting invested in somebody. And to Jose Luis's credit, he finally figured out the psychology. So kudos to Adonis for helping this guy get his head out of his ass and get him an idea of what to do here. And I thought it was fantastic. It was a great top to bottom match in that sense. The Noogie move aside, you ever notice also, JR, they always a lot of credit. I mean, New Japan should probably get royalties because what's his name? Gorilla even said it to Putski. I couldn't even imagine this. Everybody who's been gone for a while was on a tour of the Orient.
Yes, yeah, they say it, yeah.
The Orientals. Could you imagine fucking Putski in a fucking match in New Japan? I mean, seriously, could you imagine?
I mean, Adonis may have
actually. Putski and Ricky Choshu. I mean, come on.
Right. I mean, Adonis may have actually gone there during that time. Like, that wouldn't surprise me. But, yeah, no, Putski over there is kind of an odd.
Yeah, he's sitting there eating fucking lo mein or whatever, you know, sushi or something. Anyway, there you go. So Adonis wins in 10:29 with the Japanese Noogie sleeper. And whatever it was, but I enjoyed it very much. Yeah. It was great. So a supple win for the supple Adonis. All right, next up we have probably
supple tits.
Yes, the suppleness of it. We have a probably again. Usually these MSG shows are kind of a tri-part main event. Probably usually three matches. This is one of them, and I was looking forward to this one as well. So what do we got?
We have Bob Orton, the Cowboy Ace Cowboy, taking on the Junkyard Dog. Good match on paper here. Wakes that crowd up after that opening slog of matches. Orton draws his usual good heat. JYD gets a big pop as he enters to another one bites the dust. Gorilla and Alfred discuss the cast as a weapon as we get underway with some histrionics and stalling between the two. Orton really continues to build the heat by bailing to the floor to gain his bearings. Orton gets a few shots in, but JYD easily escapes and keeps calling out the cast while distancing himself. Orton levels JYD with an uppercut, but misses a blow with the cast, and the referee keeps warning Orton about using it, and that pisses off the ace as JYD stands ready. JYD grabs a chin lock and grinds away until Orton fights up and rams Dog into the buckle to break the hold. JYD comes right back and slugs Orton and then rattles Ace's head for two before going back to the chin lock. Orton works free and hits a backbreaker to cut JYD down before smashing him with a falling elbow. Orton takes his time, gets caught with an uppercut coming off the second rope, staggering him. Orton begs JYD in and slings him out to the floor. Orton follows out, clobbers him and then slips back in. JYD crawls to the ring, into the ring, where Orton meets him with stiff boots and a flurry of punches. JYD blocks a bulldog and shoves Orton to the corner and then cracks him with a clothesline for one. JYD then slugs Orton again, sending him to the floor. And Orton pulls back up and tries to suplex JYD to the floor, but Dog blocks it and suplexes him inside to a big pop. JYD whiffs on a falling headbutt, but Orton's able to climb to the top and level JYD with the cast. Orton covers to the pin, but the ref DQs Orton for using the cast. Orton tries to nail JYD with it after the bell, but Dog dodges him, and the ace retreats. I thought this was a pretty fun veteran match. I thought it built nicely. I like the story around the cast where Dog kept calling it out, the ref kept warning him, and then it plays into the finish where it gets paid off at the end where Orton uses it and gets DQ'd. It also builds future stories of Orton, too, where like the cast is becoming a big part of his match and his offense. Right. And I thought the crowd loved it. They bought into all the cast stuff, too. So I went 2.5 on this. You know, pretty much a steady veteran, two veterans going out there, knowing how to work a match and getting over the cast stuff along the way.
Yeah, I'll give this 2. I liked it a lot. Longest match of the night so far at 14:40, and that I was fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good sprint. Hadn't seen Orton in a while. And JYD, you know, he doesn't become like the really drizzling shits worker for a while. And the crowd wakes up from this. JYD at the time right now, probably top three. Well, I shouldn't say probably. I think he is top three babyface, probably after Tito and Hogan. And the crowd's just into it.
And Andre. Just I mean, he's
up. Andre, yeah. Yeah, obviously Andre is too. The only reason I don't really count Andre is because obviously his appearances are fewer and farther between. But yeah, definitely. He's in that rarefied air. One thing about Orton, and it kind of goes along with what I said about what we talked about last match with Adonis. Orton knows how to read an audience, and you could tell again as we've said. I mean, Adonis and kind of helped and Rivera kind of boosted the crowd up a little bit, but obviously the crowd's not been that engaged early on in this show. So these two guys, this was a good spot for them because they really wrote the crowd up. JYD's JYD. Orton, we all know who Orton's boy is, and we'll get to him in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they really turned up the volume, the energy volume. And another great Alfred line: Orton has tremendous ligament strength. What does that even mean?
Well,
I have tremendous strong ligament strength. I have strong ligaments. JYD matches have a lot of histrionics. You know, a lot of, as you said, a lot of movement. JYD brings an entertainment package with him. Obviously, he's not the, you know, smoothest worker in the bunch, but he does bring a good energy level and a histrionics and adds a lot of entertainment value to his matches. And Orton's a great foil for that. So I thought this was a good match for these two. And I agree with you. Maybe a little – I want to give it 2.5. I don't think it reached that level, but that quite extra star, half star, but – it was definitely the best match of the night so far. The crowd, I think, has finally woken up a little bit. And I think we're for a good rest of the show. So I think Orton, JYD, and these last two matches have saved the crowd because those first three matches were the audience was not there. But I think Rivera, Adonis, and definitely Orton and JYD have definitely lifted the energy level in the building. And we're back to like good old MSG house show crowd buzz. So good job by both these guys to get the crowd back into the show. So JYD wins by DQ. I like that Orton kind of pretend thought he won and didn't. That's a good heel, you know, heel trope there. And JYD wins by DQ at 14:40, longest match of the evening. I think it ends up being the longest match of the night as well. All right, next up, JR, another debut. And this is a guy you mentioned during Jeff Jarvis's report.
Mm-hmm.
Taking on another newcomer, although he's already been on the show a couple times. His brother is in Ohio. Columbus, Ohio. Bigly.
Terry Funk. His wrestling career began in 1965, working in the NWA territory in Amarillo, Texas, for his father, Dory Funk Sr. He and his brother, Dory Jr., together tagged as well as rising into the upper card against top names in the business. 1975, Terry won the NWA World Heavyweight title over Jack Briscoe and held the title for 14 months before posting to Harley Race, trading the title to Harley Race. Following the loss of the title, Terry and his brother traveled to different territories, Japan and Puerto Rico included. Funk came to WWF in 1985 and really stirred things up. As we mentioned earlier, had the incident with Mel Phillips, which of course is referenced here as well, as he battles another newcomer that we talked about last show, and that is Lanny Poffo. Funk takes his time disrobing, gets into it with Phillips again here. He swats at him, and Phillips runs away, continuing their little feud. Poffo and Funk lock up off the bell, and Funk grabs a brief control. Funk begs off away from a punch and then just stares at Poffo as he flips around with cartwheels and shit. That was really funny. Like, Funk just laying there staring at him, and even cracked up Alfred and Gorilla. Funk begs off from another punch and then lays in some chops off for the lockup, and Gorilla says Poffo will be a real player here once he puts it all together. Funk keeps laying in hard strikes but gets knocked outside. After regrouping, he climbs in the ring and ties up with Poffo again until Poffo grabs control of the arm. Funk backs himself into the ropes and rolls again, breaking the hold by leveraging Poffo hard to the floor in a great-looking spot. Funk kicks Poffo to the head, driving him to the edge of the ring on the way down. Poffo makes it back in and is able to land the atomic drop that sends Funk careening to the floor. Funk recovers, comes back in, and starts to slug away, mixing in headbutts as well. Funk is all over Poffo and takes him down by the leg, but Poffo kicks out of a figure four attempt and starts to fire away. Funk is wobbling as Poffo keeps laying in the shots, but Funk plants him the shoulder block and then stumbles back from the collision. Funk stands up on the edge of the apron and hoists Lanny up and then drops him hard to the floor. Funk comes out and smacks him with a couple of headbutts and suplexes him into the ring for two. Funk follows with a neckbreaker for two as Alfred says Funk will take two or three blows just to land one. Lanny pops up, gets a sunset flip for two, and the bell rings by accident. Lanny fires away with forearms and then shoots Funk hard into the corner where he ends up draped across the top rope. Poffo then lays on his back under him and just keeps kicking him in the gut until Funk flies to the floor. Gorilla calls it a wasted effort move by Poffo because it didn't accomplish much and he used a lot of energy. Poffo slams Funk in the ring and hits a moonsault off the middle rope for two. Funk sits up and nails Poffo with a flurry of right hands, but Poffo pops up and gets a head scissors takeover for another two count. Funk is up first and just buries a kick to the gut and then grabs a tight sleeper hold. Poffo fights up to a huge pop, but Funk cranks him back down and holds on for the win. I thought it was a really good match. It was a quick back-and-forth pace. Even with all the stalling and submission attempts, it just kept chugging along. Neither man ever controlled for too long. Funk's constant movement and stooging mixed nicely with Poffo's antics, and Funk really laid in some heavy wood when he was on offense. There's a lot of instant chemistry here as well, and the crowd has bought into it all. And I thought Funk was a great addition to a very strong heel slate that we already have. I went 3 stars on this, my surprise match of the night. I really dug it. I thought this is just like classic Funk, just bouncing around, stooging around, and Poffo just getting all the shit in and you know, clicking with the crowd.
Yeah, I love Funk matches. Your length 13:02, so another good long one. This was actually a pretty good combination because even for comedic purposes, you know, Poffo's just kind of this, you know, hey, you know, my cartwheels and my, you know, his gimmick. And Funk's like, I have no time for this. I'm just going to beat the shit out of you. I don't think I ever thought Mel Phillips actually came to the Garden. I thought he was a strict Philly guy. I didn't even know. That kind of surprised me that he was even there. Usually he's a Spectrum guy. But any Funk match is fun. That's a fact because he's just so unpredictable, even in the mid-80s. I mean, everybody obviously, you know, some younger fans obviously pretty much only know him from in the 90s in ECW. But he was like this in 1985. He was even like this in 1975. You know, a lot of older fans and Will be very proud of me for saying this, but it goes, he was like this in 1981 when he was feuding with Lawler in Memphis. So Funk's just the way this is what he is. He's just unhinged and it's a great gimmick. And it was unique to see it in a Madison Square Garden setting because usually you don't see that kind of unhinged unpredictability out of a guy, at the Garden. You know, everything seems to be very structured, very proper, very – and him being there actually kind of adds a little unpredictability and
right.
some entertainment that we normally don't see from an MSG house show and from the guys on it. So I enjoyed it. It was, you know, it was fun. I liked the – I liked when the girl was like, I don't know why he did that. I just didn't do anything and what a jerk. That's what it sounded like.
They've really been entertaining. They've worked in a lot of comments. You got sarcastic Gorilla Alfred just with his inane observations. Like it's been entertaining so far.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed the combo. I know I drill on Mean Gene a lot. Mean Gene wasn't bad in a lot of spots, but that's not his cup of tea. He's an interviewer. He's not a table guy. Alfred's a pretty good table guy. So there you go. Funk wins it in 13:02, and. Yeah, pretty solid match. Third straight match that the crowd has stayed in it because you've had a bunch of guys that know psychology and know how to read the energy of a crowd. So, all right, in-house, JR, we are at intermission. So I don't even think Mean Gene's even here because Gorilla actually goes backstage. And we got some interviews. Who do we got?
Well, we got a really good one to start where he chats with Roddy Piper. Piper makes fun of Gorilla's suit, calls him sexy, and says he looks cute and he should get together with Paul Orndorff. Piper climbs up on the locker so he can be taller than Gorilla and says no one could handle being in his shoes. He calls Orndorff a blithering idiot that lost the big match and then blamed Piper for it. Piper's still a winner, and he doesn't know what it's like to be a loser. Gorilla asks if he'll be going after that $25,000 bounty, and Piper says for $25,000 he would sell his grandmother to the Huns. This is a great interview. I love Piper climbing up in the lockers to be tall. And just this at his best, his rambling, sarcastic best. It was really good. I enjoyed it. Then Gorilla chats with Brutus Beefcake and Johnny V and says their reputation will be tested tonight as they try and climb the ladder. Beefcake says his opponent, George Wells, is a force to be reckoned with, but he can't stop this steamroller. V then rags on Gorilla and says he'll be at ringside tonight to witness the annihilation and that it won't even last 3 minutes. In our final interview, Gorilla talks to Paul Orndorff. Orndorff says Piper blames everything on him, but that's in the past. Piper only cares about winning and losing, but Orndorff only cares about settling the score here tonight. He says that anyone who runs around in a dress isn't man enough to pin him. And, of course, that leads us into our next match off the intermission, and that is a big-time match between Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff as the feud rages on following their Mania split up. Piper has antagonized Orndorff left and right, and Orndorff just wants revenge. Paul comes in red hot and slugs away like a madman, knocking Piper to the floor, and then he follows him outside with more blows. Back inside, Orndorff levels Piper with an elbow off the top and then continues to unleash hell as the crowd is just going wild. Orndorff starts to work the arm, but Piper looks at him and then slaps him across the face and then runs Orndorff into the corner. Orndorff shakes off the blow and keeps hold of the wrist lock, taking Piper down and yanking his arm with a snap chicken wing. Piper catches a charging Orndorff with a knee to the face and levels him with a clothesline and some kicks. Piper's favoring his elbow as he works over Paul, but Orndorff gets a flash backslide for two. Piper goes to the eyes and keeps hammering away, kicking Orndorff to the floor. Orndorff pulls Piper out and grabs a headlock, but Piper shoves him hard to the steel post and slides back inside. Orndorff slowly makes his way back in and catches Piper with a shot to the gut, but Piper grabs a front face lock and pulls him to the mat. Both men keep tussling on the mat as Piper maintains control until Orndorff bridges out into a backslide. Orndorff starts to fire back as the two men trade blows until Wonderful wins the battle and sends Piper fading to the mat. Orndorff buries an elbow to the head and then keeps bringing the heat before diving at Piper with a crossbody that takes both over the top. They trade blows out there until Orndorff slips back in and pulls Piper with him. Orndorff keeps spiking Piper's head hard to the mat and the apron and then yanks him across the top rope, spiking him hard again. The crowd is ballistic here as Orndorff climbs up to the top, but Orton shows up and shoves him to the mat for the DQ. Orndorff tries to fight off both guys, but Orton and Piper recover and tie him up until Orton nails him with the cast. Piper and Orton keep double-teaming as Orndorff starts leaking blood. They take him over to the with a double suplex, and then Piper smashes him with the cut in the cut with a soda can. The beating continues until the British Bulldog show up to make the save. I thought this match was a great wild brawl, tons of heat. As perfect as a booked of a match as you expect for this feud. I thought it was a good finish, too, with Orton making the save for his brother. Fun stuff that keeps the feud boiling and also plays off the bounty angle with the post-match attack as Piper and Orndorff were trying to get the money. I thought the post-match blood was good. I love the soda can shot. I went 3.5 for this whole thing, and I want more from these guys. This is a fantastic feud.
I was going to give it 6 stars in the Meltzer. No, I'm not. I'm going to give it 4, actually. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It's for many reasons. Number one, the crowd finally, I mean, this is it. This is what they've been waiting for. They knew this match was happening. I feel like they were sitting on their hands. The last few matches kind of got them going, but this is the one they were waiting for. And you know what's funny, JR? Good booking here by Vince, because I think this is the first time Piper's been in the building since Mania. So it's been really building from since March 31st. I don't know if we've seen Orndorff. We may have. I'm not sure. I don't remember. But we definitely have not seen Piper here since March 31st. So the crowd's just been waiting for the moment for Orndorff to get a piece of him. And so great job by Vince to keep Piper out of the building since WrestleMania to really build that energy.
Yeah,
level
we
up.
Saw. Well, we saw the match with Hogan in Toronto.
Right.
I feel like he was on. Wasn't he on in May or something? Maybe not. Maybe I'm just thinking of that MSG House show.
Yeah, I don't think Piper's been in the building. I don't think he's been in the Garden since WrestleMania. I think he's been in other places. I know a couple times he's been in the alternative building. I think the one house show we had where they were out in Oakland, I think he was there. But I don't think Piper's been in the building since Mania. So that I think that just brings it to such a different level. It's also the most ass Piper shown. I mean, he let Orndorff pretty much beat the snot out of him for most of this match. I mean, Piper got his shots in, but But Orndorff really got a lot of offense in, and at this time, Piper pretty much let nobody get any offense in. So, I mean, it was a fun brawl. And what's sad is I don't think you'll see these two have it as good again since after this time.
We do. It's going to be another show we review. Remember, they fight again, and it's really good?
No, I know they fight again. I know we do another show where they fight again. I feel like even that one's not as good as this.
We'll see. I remember being pretty good. And you're right. Right. Orndorff has not been an MSG since Mania.
Yeah, and neither's Piper. So, I mean, the crowd's through the roof. The post-match beatdown is so fucking great when they're smashing the can. Because at first I didn't know what it was. I actually had to watch it again. I'm like, what the hell did Piper just grab from the... I thought he grabbed the little ring bell hammer thing. And I'm like, what the fuck is he grabbing? And then they say, I think Gorilla says it, and it's a soda can. And I'm like, wow, he fucking pasted him with it. It was tremendous. The heat's through the roof. The Bulldog, I mean, they're really, it's, and that tells you where there's a lack of baby faces on this night when the Bulldogs had to come out to save. It had nothing to do with it.
I was waiting for JYD. I figured he'd come out playing off the match earlier.
Exactly. So when I saw Davey Boy and Dynamite, I'm like, what the fuck are these guys doing here? Weird. But then I realized there's barely any baby faces here. So, I give this 4 stars. This is a fantastic top-to-bottom package. Crowd heat, psychology, physical brawling, laying into each other with stiff shots. The beatdown after is great. This was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And what we see out of Orndorff from here on out as a babyface, it's a shame that it didn't sustain, but we'll get more into that over time. Mm-hmm. I love this. This was outstanding. It made the show. I know this, you know, you can't really make this match last. I mean, you could have made this match last, but even Hogan matches aren't last. So, this was really good. This was really good. I enjoyed it a lot. I highly recommend finding this match on YouTube. It's a good example of a good, hot, nuclear brawl at the Garden.
Filled with hate. I mean, you both guys hate each other so much.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Your match length, 8:43. Mm. Yeah, why couldn't they give?
It was fine. You know what? I don't think this should have been longer. It was such a pace and such anger. Like, I don't want it to go longer. Like, I just want this, you know, burst of hate, and then Orton makes a save. Like, I thought it was, like, actually a perfect length. Like, I don't think – you don't want these guys going 14 feet because then you got to slow it down. You got to do – you know, this wasn't a match with rest holds and stuff, you know?
Right, that's true. That's a good point. That's true. So 8:43 is fine. They could have given more to other – they could have skipped this next match after the break altogether. But all right. Why don't we take a break? The match definitely – this show is definitely woken up. I was a little – concerned after the first three matches.
It was pretty bad up until the Orton match. Now, the last two have definitely helped turn it around.
Yep, and Funk being here and the Adonis. Definitely the last four matches have picked up for the first three stinkers. But when we return, we've got, we've got four matches left, I think. Four matches left. The main event, our final match of the night, is a taste of things to come. Mm-hmm. Supplement taste to come. We are at Madison Square Garden. It is July 13th, 1985. More after this. But first, many words.
It's as supple as her voluptuous breasts.
Breast and palma, supple palma.
In the summertime, when the weather is hot, you can just ride up and touch the sky. When the weather's right, you got women on your mind.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Basement Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaySimulation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the PlaySimulation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaySimulation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySimulation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySimulation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly, longtime announcer with the WWE. No better place to be than right here on the Place to Be podcast. Make sure you tune in every week.
Alright, Nation, we are back looking at the July 1985 Madison Square Garden house show, and as you hear under us, the dulcet tones of Duran Duran's A View to Kill, and we were talking about Matt Rotella earlier, so maybe that's fine, we haven't heard that song, I don't know. But as always, as we come out of break, Scott, we take a little detour from the action inside the garden to take our pop culture corner with Criscolo, talking about the movies and music and sports of the day, so the floor is yours, Papa Scott.
Thank you, sir. You heard A View to a Kill. It was the number one song that week. Now, again, this is a Saturday, so it actually came out that day.
Wow.
And A View to a Kill, the top 100 came out that day. So A View to a Kill, which you've talked about, it was number two last week, up to number one this week. Going through the rest of the top 10 real quick, and then we're going to veer off of music and go back to it at the end because we have a huge thing to talk about, because a huge event in music took place on this day, and we'll get to it in a minute. Number two, dropping out of the number one spot, Little Studio by Phil Collins. Number three, Raspberry Beret by Prince and the Revolution, stays where it is. At number four, The Search is Over by Survivor, we talked about that. At number five, The Eurythmics. We haven't really talked about that much, JR. Would I Lie to You? Would I Lie to You? Oh, yeah. Number six, Every Time You Go Away by Paul Young, which I got so sick of back in the day.
Every time you go away.
That's a big sure dentist office song.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it was in a random RSV episode sitting on the radio in the background. Number seven, JR, the first song, I believe it's the first song we have from an icon of the industry, an icon of music. I believe this is our first Whitney song. You Give Good Love.
You Give Good Love.
Number seven. Number eight, Voices Carry by Till Tuesday. Very good song, actually. Number nine, The Boss, Bruce Springsteen with Glory Days. And number 10, kind of fitting for us, JR, The Goonies Are Good Enough by Cyndi Lauper. I don't remember that song, to be quite honest with you. The last song we had, JR, of course, which was Heaven by Bryan Adams, dropped all the way down to 12.
Good.
A week later, so it is
where it belongs, in the toilet.
It is gone. it's a tremendous song. All right, so there's your top 10. We're going to take a breather from music for the moment. We're going to get back to it shortly because we got a lot to talk about, and I want that to be last. So let's continue on. In sports, only one sports thing to talk about. That is, of course, baseball, Major League Baseball going on. We're in the heat of summer, sir. All the locals. This man sounds like Warner Wolf. Everybody was in action on this Saturday. The Yankees with a nice win at the stadium. They beat the Rangers 3-1 behind Phil Niekro.
Suck it, Texas.
That's right. And the Mets, both teams played the Texas teams. The Mets were at the Astrodome, and they blew out the Astros 10-1.
Yes.
Your standings, JR, and we talked about your Bombers making a big move. They were mired in fourth when we were last here, but they have made a run. They're 48-36, second place in the AL East.
Red hot.
Three and a half games behind the Toronto Blue Jays. So the Blue Jays still
lead. Blue Jays, we're coming for you.
Yep. Taking the field. In the AL West, the Angels still lead the West by 6 games over Oakland and 7.5 over the Royals. Hmm. The Royals only 43-42. In the East, the Cardinals have finally made their push. They lead the Mets by 2.5 games and the Expos by 3.5. And in the West, the Dodgers are now a half game ahead of the Padres. So there's baseball. And that's it for sports. We talk about artists that have played the Garden since we were last, mm-hmm. Since we were last here. In July, JR, the first, actually 4th of July, the 1st and 2nd of July, Phil Collins was here at the Garden for the No Jacket Required World Tour. Tremendous album. And so you heard a lot of SSS Studio. And so there you go. That was earlier in the month of July. Phil Collins was at the Garden. And movies. We only got one movie to talk about.
Oh.
So one movie came out the night before, July 12th. Are you ready? It made $9.87 million. It's an adventure movie. I think I saw this. I don't really remember. The movie is called Explorers. That's it. It's just Explorers.
Well, let's look into it.
I bet you it's probably something with Corey Feldman in it.
It is a science fiction fantasy film starring Ethan Hawke, River Phoenix, in their film debuts. And Jason Presson as teenage schoolboys who build a spacecraft to explore outer space. Hmm. So they got Hawk and Phoenix making their big debut. Ben Crandall, young teen living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., has vivid dreams of flying through the clouds over a vast city-like circuit board.
Exactly. So, yeah. So there you go. So that was the only movie that came out that week.
His friend is a childhood prodigy, Wolfgang Muller.
Poor bastard. Okay. So we were talking about music. Let's get back to music. Now, going into this year, when you think about huge benefit concerts, you know, concerts for a cause or a fundraiser, what have you, the two that come to mind, as a matter of fact, JR, the two that come to mind both happened in this building. August 1st, 1971 at the Garden, George Harrison, former Beatle. They were broken up at that point. Did the concert for Bangladesh, actually a very legendary show. They made an album out of it and a film actually. And they made money for they raised close to $250,000 for Bangladesh relief, which in 1971, $250,000 is a lot of money. Mm. Administered by UNICEF. They were having obviously drought issues, and we'll get to that. We'll get to it's very close to what we talk about in a moment. But so that was really the first. Big benefit show that involved a cause. And then the other one, which was also here at the Garden, which took place later in the decade, was the they called them officially No Nukes, the Muse Concerts for a Non-Nuclear Future. It was a concert that took place, a couple of shows that took place between September 19th through the 23rd, 1979, here at the Garden. A bunch of recording artists. Bruce Springsteen, James Taylor, Carly Simon, you know, the usual singer-songwriter, you know, hippies. They were all anti-nuclear power. This is, of course, right after the Three Mile Island accident in Pennsylvania.
Adam Bomb was born.
And yeah, well, even though we got a great wrestler out of it and a fantastic faction called the Bomb Squad.
We may, you know, they may want to bring that concert back with the way things are going these days. It's time for the, time for the No Nukes concert to make a return.
Yes. So, so there you go. So that was, so that happened in 79. Now, one of the big international issues that was taking place in the mid-80s was the famine in opium. What are we in? We're not in Singapore.
We're in Oz. But,
we're yeah. Was the famine in Africa, particularly in Ethiopia? Mm-hmm. They had a terrible drought for many, many months in 84 and 85. So there was no water. They couldn't grow food. I mean, you all remember the pictures, the little kids with the big bellies. Believe me, those bellies were not full of food. It was all distended. You know, it was terrible. So a guy by the name of Bob Geldof, who was in a band called the Boomtown Rats, decided to do something about it. So that's, of course, when they made the USA for Africa album. Mm-hmm. And, of course, had a song that we know very well, JR, and we talked about it in the past here on the Billboard, was We Are the World, which is an iconic song. Well, Bob Geldof wanted to take it one step further, and he wanted to do something similar to Bangladesh and – well, not really the No Nukes, but more like Bangladesh, where they wanted to make money for this cause. So, JR, on July 13th, 1985, on this day, while this house show is going on, guess what took place?
Sally Struthers.
No, not eating veal roll. No, he wasn't eating veal roll-ups with Starvin' Marvin. No, Live Aid.
Yes.
Took place. Live Aid took place on July 13th, 1985, in two venues simultaneously. One took place at Wembley Stadium in London that started at noon local time, which meant 6 a.m. our time.
And the Ethiopians are going to eat whether they want to or not. You think that kid was there?
Yes.
From SummerSlam?
Yes. I forgot about that. And then at noon local time or Eastern time here in the States, JFK Stadium in Philadelphia started. So
yes,
here
that was actually I believe it was an episode of the Goldbergs this season where they're trying to go to Live Aid. I thought you were going to say Philly. I wanted to let you say it before I jumped the gun, but I'm pretty sure they did a whole episode about going to the concert.
Going to Philly? Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, they live in Philly, so that's why.
Oh, okay. I gotta watch that show. I don't watch it. All right, so here was the bands that played at Wembley. Some of you'll know, obviously, as I move down the list, the bands will be a little more familiar to you. Coldstream Guards, Status Quo, The Style Council, The Boomtown Rats, so Bob Geldof's band played, Adamant, Ultravox, Spandau Ballet, Elvis Costello, Nick Kershaw, no relation to Clayton, Sade. She did not sing Smooth Operator. I don't think the song came out yet.
Let me guess what Spandau Ballet played. Did they play True? Do they have any other songs?
Of course they played. They played two songs and True. Yes, yeah. They did.
Or let's say, did they play True three times?
I don't know. Sting and Phil Collins played together. They did Roxanne, a couple of Sting solos, Against All Odds, Message in a Bottle, In the Air Tonight, and, of course, Every Breath You Take. He did not play Easy Lover. Howard Jones, Brian Ferry, Paul Young. Yes, Every Time You Go Away. Oh, God, I would have shot myself. U2, who was pretty popular even in 85.
Whatever.
Dire Straits, Queen. And, of course, Queen's performance is lauded as one of the best of both cities. David Bowie, The Who, Elton John. Freddie Mercury and Brian May came out alone for another song. Paul McCartney came out alone, and he.
How long was this fucking concert? Jesus,
it was. It was. It ended It ended at 10 o'clock. It was 10 hours.
Jesus,
it's a 10-hour show. 10 hours there and 10 hours in Philly. We'll get to Philly in a minute. Paul McCartney then played with, sang with Bowie, Geldof, a couple other people, and Pete Townsend, and they sang "Let It Be," and then Band Aid finished with "Do They Know It's Christmas." Do they know? Okay, so that was at Wembley Stadium. Here was the set at. John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia. Bernard Watson, Joan Baez, The Hooters, Four Tops, Billy Ocean, and yes, he did play Caribbean Queen.
Yes.
Black Sabbath, and they did play Iron Man. Run DMC, they played Jam Master Jay and The King of Rock. I love The King of Rock. Rick Springfield, REO Speedwagon, and they did Can't Fight This Feeling and Roll With The Changes. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Judas Priest, Bryan Adams, he did not do Heaven.
Good.
The Beach Boys, George Thorogood and the Destroyers, Simple Minds, and yes, they did do Don't You Forget About Me, The Pretenders, Santana, Ashford Tito. And Simpson.
That's yes. Why he wasn't at this show.
Yeah, exactly. Carrying around his new belt. Ashford and Simpson with Teddy Pendergrass, Madonna, she did Holiday, Into the Groove, and then some other song. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Kenny Loggins, he did Footloose.
This Is It.
No, he did not do This Is It, because Footloose had just come out, I think.
No.
The Cars, Neil Young, The Power Station, and they did Get It On, The Thompson Twins, Eric Clapton, Phil Collins, who actually got on a plane and flew from Wembley to Philly and then played. And then, of course, the other big moment in Philly, the highly anticipated but poorly done Led Zeppelin reunion. They did three songs, and I can't believe I'm saying this because I love Zeppelin, although Greeny will love hearing this, but they sounded atrocious. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Duran Duran, Patti LaBelle, Hall & Oates, and yes, they did not do Kiss on my list, though. Then
did they do Rich Girl?
They
That'd be a little
did not,
insensitive. Okay.
I know. They did Out of Touch, Man Eater, Get Ready, Ain't Too Proud to Beg, The Way You Do the Things You Do, and My Girl.
Wow, they really went for it. Huh? Well, this song's kind of short anyway.
Yeah. And then a combo thing here, Mick Jagger, Hall & Oates, Eddie Kendricks, David Ruffin, who's in the Four Tops, and then Tina Turner, they did a bunch of songs. Bob Dylan, Keith Richards, and Ronnie Wood did three songs, and then it ended at 5 of 11. So this concert ended after this house show did.
Jesus.
And then they ended. Everybody came out, and they all sang We Are the World. So there you go.
Let me ask you, as a music buff, music lover, especially of this era,
yep.
If you could pick to be front row at either of these shows, which one are you choosing?
London.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I would love to have seen, as much as I love Led Zeppelin.
I feel like the depth in Philly was better.
The depth in Philly was better, but I feel like the back end of London was, I mean, Queen, Bowie, The Who, Elton. I mean, those four alone for me are heavyweights. Philly was very good, but I think
Elton,
literally
a heavyweight. Yeah.
Yes, he is. U2, Dire Straits, Queen, Bowie, The Who, and Elton all in a row. I'm all for that. The only thing I would have missed would have been the London people stay at Wembley and the rest of the concert in Philly was on a screen. So it's not like they left. They stayed for the whole thing and the rest of the concert in Philly was on a screen. I'm trying to look right now for the final how much they made, because I'm sure they made a fucking shitload. Fundraising. Throughout the concerts, viewers were urged to donate money to the Live Aid cause. 300 phone lines were manned by the BBC so that members of the public could make donations using their credit cards. The phone number and an address that viewers could send checks to were repeated every 20 minutes. Nearly 7 hours into the concert in London, Bob Geldof inquired how much money had been raised. He was told £1.2 million. I don't know what that is. So he was said to have been sorely disappointed by the amount and marched to the BBC commentary position, pumped up further by a performance by Queen. Geldof gave an interview in which he used the word fuck. Apparently he was a real dick. So,
well, he busted his ass. You know, he wants to see some money come in.
After the outburst, giving increased by 300 pounds per second. So there you go. So they made some pretty good money. Notable, you heard me mention some notable absences. Think about the era, JR. No Bruce Springsteen. He simply did not realize how big the whole thing was going to be, and he expressed his regret. Michael Jackson also refused to take part. And according to Joan Baez, Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder attempted to organize a boycott. Why? Because there was no—and he couldn't say it's because there was no black artists, because the Four Tops were there,
right,
as well as Tina Turner, so I don't know if that was the problem. But Prince did not play.
No foresight, but from Stevie there.
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. That is terrible. Prince did not play, but did send a pre-tape video of an acoustic version of For the Tears in Your Eyes. The original version, I don't know why he wasn't there, but Billy Joel, Boy George, Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson.
Billy Joel is tied up in Dr. G's basement, and he couldn't make it.
Yes, exactly. Doing his own personal show. Tears for Fears, Huey Lewis, and Paul Simon were all included in the initial promotional material, but failed to appear. Rod Stewart wasn't there. It doesn't mention why. Stewart was not touring at the time, was ultimately unable to put together a band in time, as was Billy Joel, who actually did not like the idea of performing solo in front of such a big stadium.
He plays he's a piano man. Get out there and play the piano.
I know,
you need a fucking band
weird.
For
I have always said that to G, and G kind of agree. He's kind of weird like that.
Go play the fucking piano. That's your whole thing. He could have went out there and did Piano Man and been out.
Yeah, exactly. Cat Stevens wasn't there. Liza Minnelli gave a fuck about her. Cyndi Lauper wasn't there.
No, she was busy. She was fending off Fabulous Moolah.
Exactly, yes. And a bunch of others weren't there either.
If Lanny Kai is going to be there, I'm not going to be there.
What?
I said, if Lanny Kai is going to be there, I'm not going to be there.
Lanny Kai! A sighting of George Harrison arriving Wednesday night at the Heathrow Airport led to widespread speculation that the three living Beatles, of course, John Lennon was dead, that the three living Beatles was in the works. He was approached by Geldof to join McCartney at Let It Be, answering, Paul didn't ask me to sing on it 10 years ago. Why does he want me now? Yeah, they were still kind of pissed off at each other. So anyway, a pretty epic show. Mm-hmm. They did it again in 2000-something. I know they tried it again, but and in 2004, they finally released it on DVD, but Led Zeppelin wanted to make sure that their performance, because it was really bad, was not on it. So there you go. On this date, while we're doing this house show in 1985, the biggest...
You could have ran 10 house shows in the stretch of this, know, these two
yeah,
concerts.
Exactly. I wonder if that...
What felt longer, the concert or the opening match that we watched here tonight? Fucking Putski.
Could you imagine? Ladies and gentlemen, the WWF with Ivan Putski. Maybe he can get the Polish donations to go up.
You could feel like 9 Hall & Oates songs in the length of that Ivan Putski match.
Oh, God. You make my dreams come true if you never wrestle again. Okay. All right. So there you go. So it was on this date, July 13th, 1985, that Live Aid took place. And there is your pop culture report.
All right.
So there you go. All right. Let's get back to the garden while Queen is playing and Billy Joel is not. We've got a match that, oh, God. At least this one was only, at least this one. If this one was 12 minutes, I was quitting. Absolutely not. Who do we got here?
The king of sepsis himself, the big Sweeta, is in the house. Sweet Hansen.
They were not at Live Aid.
No, they were not. The Hansen should have been. The Sweeters back to battle the former tag team champ. And we see some Iron Sheik fans in the crowd. They have the gear on and everything. And Gorilla, ever the diplomat, says, it looks like they lost their camel. So there you go. Blassie's out with Sheik as always. Nice pop for the Sweeter and his terrible hair. I mean, he has like all time worst hair.
What
Sweet
was
Hansen.
That? I was going to mention that. That's the worst dye job I've ever seen.
It's brutal. Sheik jumps Sweet at the bell, chokes him with his headdress, and then Swede's own shirt. Sheik keeps clubbing and choking away as the crowd fires up a USA chant. Sweet battles back with some chops and a side headlock, and then a slug Sheik to the mat. Sweet slams Sheik with ease and then drops a knee to the chest for one. Sweet blocks a Sheik kick and then chops him down and goes to the eyes. Sweet levies some soft-looking blows in the corner, but Sheik staves him off and loads the boot and then kicks Sweet in the chest before dropping an elbow for the win. And oh my God, Sweet did not kick out at the three count. He actually lay there. This is actually fine for what it was. This is really not much going on at all. Sweet is at the end of the line. He is moving like shit out there, just ambling around slowly. Sheik picks up a key win, kind of that they need after losing the tag titles, and rolls on. I'm good with Sweet Hansen.
I'm praying we never see him again. The dye job is
this
terrible.
This may be it. I gotta check. I wanted to check. I'll let you know.
Graham usually mentions...
Yes, this is our final Swede match. He didn't mention it, but he's not... At least for 85, he's not back here at MSG. So it's the last time we're going to see him.
Oh, thank God. The dye job is abysmal. And this match needed to be 2.5 minutes. And Sheik deserved to beat the shit out of him. It was pretty much glorified squash. Sweeter really didn't do anything.
He is around he's around until about September overall. But last time at MSG.
You know, hit the bricks. All right, next up.
I mean, just not the guy. That's it. That's what you're going to say. You don't want to say anything else?
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say. Fuck it. I don't care. No, it was an effective squash. Sheik is still hot. Mm. You know, he's a better heel. And, you know, he's a better worker than Sweet.
I'd rather, if you're going to use Sweet at this point, I'd rather him in a match like we saw with. No. I'd rather him in a match like we saw with Bundy. Another big guy with it is, you know, Battle of the Bulge kind of match. Instead of Sheik, which was much more just, I don't know, like Sheik has power offense, but the only time I really enjoyed Swede during the few matches we've seen him is when he was just banging bellies with Bundy. You know, like that was more right. fun than
That's
actually
true.
Seeing him trying to like control a man. I don't know, he just sucks and his hair is awful. But like stuff with Bundy was entertaining. This one was not.
No, and I feel bad because I feel like the crowd's about to get let down again. They had their big awesome, you know, crazy, stupid brawl. And they've had some good characters like, you know, Funk. And,
well, especially if they could have been home watching Live Aid. I mean, so that was televised, right?
Yeah, it was on MTV.
Yeah, so.
As far as I know, it was. Yeah, it was on MTV. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Maybe that's why the crowd was – maybe that's why the crowd was flat because most of them weren't there. But or they went to Philly. I mean, JFK Stadium is, mm-hmm. you know, typical football-sized stadium. So probably seats 75,000 or whatever. I don't even know. And you got to figure 1985 standards. Could tickets have been that expensive? Well, if that's D'Amato, I mean, he knows.
Yeah, I don't know.
I couldn't even imagine how much they were. Anyway, Sweeter loses and Sheik wins and that's it. Move on. Next up, we get Sheik's tag team partner in a taking on a guy that makes sense. Like he was in a match in the last show, in our last show in June, and it made no sense at all. This one actually makes sense. Who do we got?
In our next match, we have George Steele battling Nikolai Volkoff. Things continue to cool off, work rate rise here as we deal with the animal. Blassie's back out with Volkoff. They get the usual heat for the Russian national anthem. Lou Albano power walks out with George Steele, who clears the ring to a pop. After some standing around and stalling, the bell rings, and we get underway. Steele does his usual antics, and as Alfred says, his gesticulations. I love
yes.
Alfred. That Steele's crazy, so Nikolai's pantomiming how nuts Steele is. Nikolai finally attacks after a Blassie distraction and lands some kicks, but Steele battles back and then bites Volkoff. Steele gets distracted by Blassie, and Nikolai again kicks away in the corner as Gorilla yells at Albano for not helping. Nikolai keeps laying in some heavy kicks until Steele hits a low blow and knocks Nikolai back. Steele tears up and eats the turnbuckle pad and then shoves the padding into Nikolai's face. Steele grabs a side headlock, but gets distracted again by Blassie, allowing Nikolai to club away. Albano finally starts arguing with the referee, and that allows Blassie to jab Steele with the cane. Albano finally comes over to confront Blassie, but Blassie smacks him with the cane. Nikolai comes out to check on Lou, but Blassie hits him with the cane as well. Steele stalks Blassie until Nikolai makes a save and clubs away. All four men start to brawl and battle down the aisle for a double countout. There was some energy here, but not much else, just nonsense and parlor tricks. Steele's over, but useless in the ring. Nikolai is not the guy to make it work with him. Again, there's some callback here because, of course, this is, you know, Saturday's main event with him, with Volkoff, Sheik, and Steele's with Steele turned. So there's at least a little history there of why they're having this match. But, again, not a good mishmash in 1985 with these two guys. And Albano did look dumb. I mean, Gorilla's calling him out. He's just standing there as Blassie keeps distracting Steele. But this was a dud. And in the bucket for Drizzler contention, for sure.
Yeah, this match sucked. But, like I said, I mean, George Steele, last month's house show, he was in that six-man with Bobby's guys. And you're like, why is he with Bobby's guys? He has no issue with Bobby's guys. They couldn't have found anybody else. But here it makes more sense because but I think they should have reversed these two. I think Volkoff should have squashed the Sweeter, and I think Sheik should have fought Steele here. I think it would have helped a little bit more.
Yeah, maybe.
But, again, this match is only 4:18, so who really cares? I mean, the match isn't that long. Blassie smacks Albano, and he cracks George Steele. Freddie Blassie is still a tremendous manager, mm-hmm. and it worked out here. It was a good ending. It had to end this way. The match was kind of a shit show.
Albano's so fat.
I know, he really is fucking fat. I'll give him a half star.
We see a little bit more amplified on TNT. Like, I just watched one from June. And he's just, I mean, his gut, like, Vince makes fun of him because of how fat he is. He's like, I thought you were losing weight. It looks like you put on quite a bit. You know, he's just, his gut is just humongous.
Yeah, he looks terrible. He absolutely looks terrible. And, but good move by Blassie. He was very, you know, he was active for a guy who was probably in his, I don't know, 60s, yeah. late 60s, even early 70s at that point. So, I think that this feud kind of peters out. Maybe we see one more house show with it, but otherwise, no. I'm more than happy not to see anything with this combination again. So there you go. George Steele loses, right?
No, double count.
It was a double count out. Okay. Yep. So a double count out, and that's fine. I don't know why Volkoff needed protecting, but whatever. So there you go. George Animal Steele and Nikolai Volkoff to a double count out. Next up, another match, JR, that was discussed in our intermission interviews. A couple of big men from the West Coast.
Yeah, we have Brutus Beefcake tackling or attempted to tackle. George Wells, who's making his MSG debut as far as we're concerned, started out his professional career playing 8 years in the Canadian Football League with the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Saskatchewan Rough Riders, winning one Grey Cup championship. During the offseason of 1974, Wells began wrestling professionally in the San Francisco area. He had to wrestle for 3 years before moving to Stampede in 1978. Retired from football in 1980 to concentrate on his pro wrestling career in Central States and Mid-Atlantic. Debuted in WWF in 1985. Was used primarily as a preliminary wrestler on Primetime Wrestling. Say that 10 times fast. And also wrestled on several supercards. After leaving WWF, he spent time in Memphis and World Class, where he feuded with the Dingo Warrior, and retired in 1992. Began serving as a drug counselor in the San Francisco area. Good old George Wells. And, of course, that was a very memorable, I believe, was it the Maple Leaf Gardens House show we watched the adventure where Jack Reynolds and Jesse keep fucking up all the teams he played for in the CFL.
Yeah.
That was funny.
But he had his afro. Yeah.
He's got a good look, though, and Beefcake and Johnny V is still climbing the ladder. Tricky test ahead of them. Wells is feisty. We open with stalling as Beefcake slowly undresses while Wells is trash-talking Johnny V. But Wells gets tied up with V. Beefcake jumps him from behind and clubs away, choking him with his boot. Beefcake grabs a side headlock. Wells fights up and lands a boot and an uppercut into an arm drag. Wells focuses on the arm, maintaining control through a Beefcake comeback. Beefcake punches his way back into control and then knocks Wells to the floor with a knee lift. Beefcake keeps unloading with strikes until Wells runs Beefcake into the corner and goes to the arm. Beefcake slugs Wells over the top rope, but he hangs on and then skins the cat into a head scissors and that he uses to sling Beefer to the floor, which may be the best Wells move I've ever seen. So he's skinning the cat, pulls himself back up, locks the head scissors on Beefcake, and then propels him out to the floor. Like, it was really impressive. Beefcake climbs back in. He's met by a right hand and a hip toss. Wells smashes him with a running football tackle, followed by a flying shoulder block. Johnny V tangles up with Wells, allowing Beefcake to nail him from behind with a running knee for the win. Gorilla says this is why managers should be in the locker room, not at ringside. Nothing going on here. It's a rare time where Beefcake actually got dominated for most of the match and looked kind of weak. Normally, he's been kicking the shit out of everyone. But it establishes how Johnny V helps him out of the ring as well, and in the ring. Wells, I thought, looked a little bit better than normal, too. I went half a star for this one.
Yeah, I agree. It was a decent power match. Mm. I was surprised that Wells got as much offense as he did. Because Beefcake seems like a guy that's on the forefront. He's been in a lot of stuff. He had a very high profile feud, obviously, earlier in the year. So I thought that this would be more of his style or his match where he would dictate the tempo. 7:26 your time. But I did like that Johnny V kind of needed his help, and you'll see something on the horizon from these two gentlemen over the next couple of months as they gain a third member of their little group. So there you go. Brutus Beefcake wins. Mm-hmm. George Wells looked decent.
One move alone was pretty good. That was enough for me.
Exactly, me too. So
did you think it was interesting, though, that Beefcake didn't dominate? We've seen him mowing through guys. On these shows, pretty much, whether it's TNT or here. So to me, it was interesting that he actually took a lot of offense from Wells.
Yeah, no, I'm very surprised. One of the more unique kind of bizarro matches we've seen on these house shows that Beefcake took more of a beating than I thought he would. So 7:26, your time. All right, time for our final match. You could call it the main event if you'd like. The main event was probably already done, but this is our final match of the night. And JR, it's actually kind of a historic one because it is our first matchup of two teams that would dictate the tag team division for probably the next, well, besides another team for probably the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we got?
Well, we have our main event between the British Bulldogs, who we saw a few months ago in MSG, battling the Hart Foundation, a tag team put together of Jim Neidhart and Bret Hart, managed by Jimmy Hart. So remember, Jimmy Hart had taken both men under advisement. Neidhart originally was with Mr. Fuji, moved on to Jimmy Hart in April, and Jimmy Hart picked up Bret as well and said, hey, you know, these guys aren't doing much together. We're going to put them together. And I'm actually going through. It looks like their first match together was back in March. Where they teamed up. Hmm. So they've been working together now for a while, on and off. And of course, there is background with these guys. The Bulldogs had wrestled up in Stampede, worked out in the dungeon as well. So, you know, they're not related, but they would be. I don't know if Davey had married Diana yet at this point, but in any way, they're all tied together, all these guys. Neidhart and Hart, of course, are brothers-in-law. Were they married? Do you know if he was married to Elliot?
I'm going to look.
Because I know he trained in the dungeon too, Nightheart. So they might have been.
Yeah, I'm going to look at. I'm going to look. While you do your comments, I'll look it up.
I'm looking up Nightheart now. If you want to look up Bulldog.
All right, I will look up Bulldog. Let's see, personal life.
Doesn't say when he got married. It just says him and his wife have three daughters.
Okay. Personal life. He and his wife. It just says he and his wife Diana. Well, Harry was born August 2nd. He was actually born. They had to have been married because Harry was going to be born. She was pregnant. She was about to have the kid.
In 85 is when he married Ellie. Because he worked for Stu Hart Stampede from 78 to 83 and again in 85, during which time he married Ellie Hart.
Okay. Davey and Diana had two kids, and Harry was born 3 weeks after this show, August 2nd.
So
they're already married.
Okay. Yep. So there you go. These guys are all intermingled.
But Gorilla actually mentions that they're close with Davy Boy, and now they're not. Alfred kind of acknowledges that there's been a rift now within their friendship. They don't mention family or anything, obviously.
Right, they say they're close.
They do mention, though, that they know each other and that kind of thing. So
good backstory there. Great tag team match to close out the show. Hart Foundation, Fisher United, good use of both men. Nice pot for the Bulldogs, a team on the rise. Dynamite and Hart open things up and have a couple of lockups that go nowhere. Dynamite finally strikes first with a pair of arm drags and then knocks Hart to the floor after Hitman grabbed a hammerlock. Hart climbs back in and tags Anvil as Gorilla and Al make fun of how ugly Nightheart is. Dynamite survives the shoulder block, but a second one buries him. Dynamite comes back with a kick to the chest and tags in Davey. The Bulldogs knock Anvil down with a double shoulder block as Jimmy annoys Gorilla and Al with his microphone, complaining about the double team. Anvil wins a test of strength and kicks and knees Davey when he tries to fight up. Davey avoids a backdrop and lands a drop kick that sends Anvil over to tag out. Hart kicks Davey down and goes to work with punches before tagging Anvil in, who uses his power to clobber Davey and then land a backbreaker. Anvil holds on onto his knees so Brett can bury an elbow to him off the second rope, prompting Gorilla to chastise the ref for losing control. The Harts keep double-teaming as Brett lands a dropkick while Anvil just keeps clubbing away. Gorilla bitches more about the microphone as Hart comes in and goes to work. Davey gets a brief glimmer of a comeback, but Hart recovers and lands a backbreaker. Davey gets another hope spot as he gets a crucifix off an Irish whip, but Anvil breaks up that pin. Hart keeps on the offensive, but the Harts end up with miscommunication, allowing Davey to tag out. Dynamite comes in and cleans house, rattling both Harts with a great flurry of offense. Gorilla's just all over the ref here as Anvil finally leaves. Dynamite whips Hart hard into the corner and covers, but Anvil breaks it up. Dynamite nails Hart with a missile dropkick and tags in Davey, who drops Hart with a running power slam, and Anvil makes a save again. Gorilla and Alfred are just saying that this should be a DQ at this point because Anvil just keeps breaking up pinfalls, this time breaking up a small package. Davey keeps tries to roll up, but Hart ducks down, and Davey goes flying to the floor. Everything breaks down as all four guys are brawling. Things finally settle as Hart turns Davey into a Boston Crab, but now Dynamite makes a save. Anvil sneaks in behind the ref's back and takes over, and he gets the Boston Crab, but Dynamite breaks that one up too. Order gets restored as Anvil hooks a chin lock on Davey, and that leads to a tag and more double teams. Hart gets a roll-up, but Davey reverses it to prevent the count. Davey then comes back with a dropkick, but Anvil comes in and prevents the tag, allowing Hart to go back to work. Gorilla's just furious at this point, calling for another DQ, as Anvil tags in and hammers away. But just as Davey gets a sunset flip, we get the bell for the curfew draw to end the match and the show. And it's funny because the crowd immediately starts pouring out as soon as the bell rings. So they're not sticking around. A good tag match, a hectic pace, good strategy with all the double teams and saves, which helped build the heat. You know, I know Gorilla was getting frustrated at it, but I actually thought it was well done the way Anvil kept making save after save. This is good tag work, you know? And then the Bulldogs did as well. Hart and Anvil are already so smooth and efficient as a tag team, working in and out, tagging quickly, teaming together. The Bulldogs' arsenal continues to impress as well. I thought this was a solid outing with a disappointing finish with the draw, so I went 3 stars.
I gave it 3 as well. I felt like it was almost a squash. Bulldogs really didn't get a whole lot of offense in.
And almost like a showcase in some ways, too.
Almost like a what?
Like a showcase.
Yeah. You know? Yep, I agree. And I think you knew that these two teams... this match is on a couple of DVDs. I think it's on Brett's DVD, and I think it's on another one. The thing that I got out of this match, even more than the action, we have a lot of great managers right now, JR. There's no question about it. But I think right now, just based on how the announcers, how Gorilla and Alfred acted as compared to the other matches, you could say that if there is a hierarchy, that Jimmy's probably the number one manager in the company. None of the other managers annoy him annoy like people as much as he does. Like even
you
when
think
Blassie
more than Bobby.
Was, Bobby didn't. It seems like Bobby didn't do much. Yeah, and also Bobby's Bobby wrestles.
But Bobby's just coming off the big Mania thing with Andre and everything. He's got stud. I mean, we're not really seeing it here, but like with the TNTs and all that, I don't know. I feel like Bobby's still number one.
No, I don't know.
He keeps replenishing his stable. I know Jimmy's got Valentine, but Valentine was champ for like 230 days before Jimmy took over, and then he lost the belt. So, I mean, Jimmy's up there, but I feel like he's on the come up. I feel like Heenan's still number one.
Okay. I just feel like we've seen four heel managers on the show, Bobby, Johnny V, Jimmy, and Freddie Blassie, and all the others interfered, but they didn't have as much venom as they did for Jimmy in this match and even with Neidhart. So, I mean, I'm not, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I love Bobby and I just feel like Jimmy Hart was, I mean, they all came at roughly the same time from different areas of the country. I feel like at the moment, Jimmy is the house show manager and Bobby is the TV manager. That's just my opinion. That's fine. But I think it added a great energy to this match. You could tell both these teams just know their shit, so there's no issues there. They're just that good. And the curfew was disappointing, but you could see. I agree with you. I think it was a long day, and I think the fans are like, all right, whatever. I don't even care if they go 5 more minutes. I'm leaving.
they were done.
I think they were cooked at that point. So the official time was 13:12. So what does that mean? The match started at 11:17. I think 11:30. I think 11:30 was the curfew back then. So there you go. That is your main event, your last match, 13:12, and it ends in a curfew draw. All right. It's time for the awards.
All right, getting awards. Okay, so your match of the night, mine was Roddy Piper versus Mr. Wonderful.
No doubt. I mean, that was the highlight. It was the one match that the crowd was the most jacked for and kind of saved it from the show being an utter stinker. So,
all right, for my drizzler, and this is an interesting show because there's a lot of fun stuff and there's a lot of terrible shit. I thought the worst of the worst was Steel Volkoff. To me, there was like nothing redeeming. Like those first few matches, at least, like even the Morales and the other one had like again, they were technically solid. They were just boring. Like Volkoff Steel was just like nothing. I mean, it was just.
Spotty and Putski was so bad, though.
I know. But at least the crowd, so I don't know. Volkoff Steel just had nothing to offer. Just nothing to offer.
They had Blassie and the outside interference. It added a little juice. There was a backstory. I just feel like that opener was just atrocious. Yeah. I know it wasn't a dud, but it was, I mean, it was bad. I don't know. We may have to tie that one. I don't know if I want to budge off that Putski.
All right,
match.
No, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm not going to argue with it. That's fine. Putski versus Spot.
It was the shits. Yes, the George Steele match was bad, but at least the Blassie thing added some entertainment at the end, and there was supposed to be a backstory, and there was a feud involved.
It was awful.
Stop trying to defend it.
All right, MVP of the night, I went with Roddy Piper.
Oh, absolutely.
Between his interview and the match.
I would say all three of them, but definitely Piper.
Yeah, I mean, Orndorff was really good too, but I feel like between Piper's interview, let's give it to both of them because they both had really good interviews, and the match itself was fantastic. So
yeah, it was a great show. It was a great match, too. I mean, you could argue that as good as a couple of the matches later on were, if this match wasn't on the show, this could have been one of the worst MSG house shows ever.
All right, my spoiler award for worst worker, and you're not getting me off of this one, I'm going with George Steele, who's just
a
useless
definitely.
Piece of shit at this point.
He really is. I mean, nothing. I'm not putting Ivan Putski off the hook though, but
no.
He'll get second place here because George Steele's really just a mess, to be honest with you.
All right. Best moment, I went with the post match brawl between Piper and Orndorff.
Yeah, I would even specifically say the can going into his fucking head. It was pretty awesome. But yeah, the whole post match beatdown was tremendous. Crowd was getting ridiculous. Piper's just so amazing. He really is.
All right, the Mr. Wonderful Award for tonight.
We got a bunch of two-time winners on this night. This could have been Putski's second. It could be Rick McGraw's second. It could have been Orndorff's third. The only guy that couldn't defend his belt was Tony Atlas. He could have gotten a third, but he was in the other show.
I think Putski. His skin is so tight and tanned.
It's ridiculous.
And the fact that they were gushing over it so much like makes it almost even worse.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like an action figure. I mean, it's so bad. He has, like, no hair in his body left. I mean, he's got the
This is the official theme for the Mr. Wonderful Award. Although, it may not be named for him much longer. If Putski wins again, it becomes his, right? Is that what we're doing? The
yes, whoever breaks whoever has the most. Yeah. Yep. So it could be the Moon Over Parma Award.
So there you go.
That's so bad. It's so terrible.
Overall,
he had a song right after the thing with that stupid guy with the fucking
Gary
styrofoam
Spivey.
Hair or whatever. Yeah.
All right. Final grade for me, I went with a 6, which is actually I think it's my highest. No, I went 6.5 on one here, but it's up there for me as far as the shows we've watched here at MSG, which is funny because this is a lot of slop. But I feel like Piper Orndorff is so good. I really liked Orton, JYD. I really liked the Bulldogs match. And I really liked Funk Poffo. Like, those four matches, it's rare to get. I mean, we got 3 3-star-plus matches, which is odd on a house show in 1985, WWF. And then Orton, JYD, to me, wasn't far off. So it really offset a lot of that early slop. So I was looking at a 5 because I feel like it was split down the middle. But then I'm like, well, I really enjoyed those matches at the top. And I thought Gorilla and Al were, like, good enough to make that shit watchable. So that's why I landed at a 6.
I'm going to give it a 6 also. You did give Mania an 8, but I guess you're not counting Mania. You're just,
yeah, I'm talking strict house show.
Regular house shows. Okay.
I went 6.5 for that April show.
I'm going to give this a 6 as well. It is straight down the middle, but that Piper Orndorff puts it over the top for good.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the Putski and the George Steele stuff is abysmal, but I'm not gonna let that stuff ruin the awesomeness of Funk and the Piper Orndorff stuff, and even the good Adrian Adonis, Jose Luis Rivera psychology. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna let that other trash ruin that. So I'm gonna give this a 6 as well. I mean, it's a decent show. This is one of the few times I would say you don't need to watch the whole show. I would pick and choose a couple matches. I think you'll be all right. You're not going to miss much if you don't watch the other matches. And I don't say that much for MSG house shows because I just love watching them. But this one, you could pick and choose a couple of things. I wouldn't waste your time with the whole thing because some of those are – that early stuff is just – I would start the show with the Adonis-Rivera match. And then the only match I would skip after that is the George Steele shit. So it's not that – it's still good enough to be better than down the middle. So I'll give it a 6 as well.
All right, so Scott, next week we're back on Monday night, but we're actually going to take a little break from the Vintage Vault to take a moment to celebrate our 6th mm-hmm. birthday, our show here. It was February of 2011 when we kicked off, and we're going to go ahead and take a week to just reminisce a bit. I mean, I think 6 years is worth taking a moment to talk about. You know, 436 episodes is a lot of episodes across, 6 years, so... we're going to have Chad Campbell with us, and we're going to talk a little bit about the show's history, the site's history, and we're also going to talk kind of what's changed in those 6 years, whether it's sports, pop culture, wrestling, just, what are the differences from when we started? I mean, just look at wrestling alone, where we're at, WrestleMania 27 versus now, so a lot of difference. And we'll, have our usual fun and frivolity along the way. And then 2 weeks from tonight, on Monday night, February 20th, we'll be back with the August MSG show. And we're slated to have a special guest with us that we'll reveal as we get closer. So we're looking forward to that. So we're going to wrap things up, though, for tonight. You have anything coming this week?
Barring any weather issues, because as you know, JR, and those that live in this part of the country, we're supposed to get some a nasty coastal storm Wednesday night into Thursday, but I am slated to have Main Event tomorrow night. Okay. And we will preview Sunday's Elimination Chamber show. Got a couple of awesome guests. So we are planning to do that, barring the weather. If the weather is bad, we'll try and fit it in at the end of the week. We'll see. But right now we are slated to have a Main Event tomorrow night.
All right, great. I also want to give a shout out to my boys, Tim Capel and Andy Helene. I recorded an episode of Survey Says last night. That'll come out in March, I believe. They have monthly shows. We talked about the WCW themed events. We talked about Spring Breakout Nitro. We talked about MGM Studios Nitro. We talked about Halloween Havoc and Beach Blast and Soul. That was all the kind of outside the box WCW themes, the Mall of America. It was a lot of fun. Talked a lot about kind of my history as a fan with WCW, and then we got into that stuff. So. Look out for that in March. Also want to give a shout-out, of course, to the Chaps, Parvin Allen, The final Letters from Kayfabe aired last week. It was a tearful final event center for yours truly. I will miss that show. One of my favorites. If you haven't listened to it, you can hear the whole 20-episode run at PlayStation.com or the PWO feed, the Pro Wrestling Only feed on iTunes.
Really sad.
Very sad. Also, of course, the end of Titans of Wrestling, which is sad as well. One of the early flagship shows here at PlayStation Nation when we first were getting going. So Parv will still be around here or there, but pretty much going into, as he called it, comparing it to 1993 of Randy Savage. A couple big spots here or there, but pretty much into semi-retirement from a podcast point of view. So we were lucky to have him a few weeks back when he joined us for a review here. Big shout-out to those boys, both on Titans and Letters from Kayfabe. But we keep rolling on. We have new shows coming in left and right. Subscribe to all of our feeds, Place to Be Nation Wrestling, Place to Be Nation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. We'll have a new Dadcast scheduled for the weekend, episode number 2. So we'll reveal that as it goes live. And like I said, Scott, we'll be back next Monday celebrating our 6th birthday. So until then, I'm going to go watch Live Aid, all 24 hours of it, past the snowstorm. You think Mr. Wonderful will be played there?
I think Moon Over Parma will be sang by, I was going to say by Billy Joel, but he wasn't there. Maybe he'll be sang by Queen or David Bowie.
Maybe Sweet Hansen will sing Moons Over Miami.
Maybe he'll sing Moons Over My Die Job.